crime!
Self-defense is not a crime!
Self-defense is not a crime!
The Carmelo Anthony trial has erupted into a full-blown circus of racial division, media manipulation, and street-level chaos right in the heart of Collin County, Texas.
Only good cracker is a dead cracker. Only good cracker is a dead cracker. Only good cracker is a dead cracker. Only good cracker is a dead
cracker. We lack murderers. We lack murderers.
We cannot allow this injustice to stand.
What began as a tragic stabbing at a Frisco High School track meet in April of 2025, where 17-year-old Austin Metcalf was fatally knifed in the chest, has now devolved into a national powder keg. Carmelo Anthony sits in the courtroom with a haircut making him appear younger, while jury candidates admitting that they wouldn't convict such an innocent-looking child, resulting in a jury pool of hundreds narrowed down with zero black jurors.
Okay, also, I just noticed this headline, baby-faced Carmelo Anthony heads to court to stand trial for murder. Now, one thing that I forgot to report to you guys yesterday, because I did get to go inside the courthouse and I was watching the live stream of the jury selection, is that Carmelo Anthony has since shaved his head, so he even looks younger than he does in this photo. On top of that, let's not forget that his lawyer is going to be referring to him for the duration of this trial as Mello, a nickname that his lawyer states his friends and family know him by. So not only has Carmelo drastically changed his appearance with that shaved head, again, making him look much younger, but his lawyer also going to be referring to him as Mello for the duration of this trial. By the way, you have the Carmelo supporters, which I'm sure you can hear behind me. They were just chanting that they love their black youth and they deserve protection too. I am live on the ground for opening arguments of the Carmelo Anthony trial.
Prosecutors paint him as the aggressor in a sneak attack, while his defense hammers the split-second fear and chaos of the moment. But the real fireworks are exploding outside the courthouse in a display of Carmelo's self-righteous environment.
Push you if I get close enough.
Wait.
Push you right into that crack. You heard what I said, cracker. Neanderthal, I don't give a f- what you say. You cracker. You cracker.
We gotta get out of the road.
Just get out of the road, please. Get out of the road, please.
You still a cracker. You still a cracker. You're a cracker, motherfucker. You're a cracker. You're a cracker. Here, cracker. You're a cracker. You a cracker, you ain't gonna get me, cracker. They've been trying to get me, cracker. You ain't gonna get me, cracker.
This isn't just about one knife in the chaos of a track meet. It's another flashpoint exposing how America's justice system and public discourse have been hijacked by identity politics. The trial grinds on, but the real verdict on whether truth can still prevail in this divided republic continues to hang in the balance.
Get my face on the camera. We kill crackers. Where I come from, we kill them. And we, if I ever see you outside of Texas, you gonna have a problem. Yep. I'm gonna wrap you up in that flag and I'm gonna set it on fire. I like the smell of burning flesh. Don't you? Don't you? Don't you? See, the time of you having fear on us is over, cracker. It's over, cracker. We ain't scared of you.
John Bound reporting for the Alex Jones Network at alexjoneslive.com.
That's the latest Bound report. Find and share it at alexjoneslive.com. Bound report, Carmelo Anthony, circus of hate. It's a circus of hate, and the clowns are in town. And we're getting a lot of updates as to the latest witness testimony during the Carmelo Anthony trial. We'll bring you that news and so much more on the other side. Stay with us. It's War Room Live on Alex Jones Network, AJN Live on X. Follow us there. Share the link, and we'll be right back. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to War Room Live. This is your host, Harrison Smith, speaking. We're coming to you live on the Alex Jones Network. Our website is, of course, alexjoneslive.com. That's alexjoneslive.com. You can follow us on Rumble, rumble.com/thewarroomlive, or just search The War Room Live. But that's our official channel, rumble.com/thewarroomlive. And, of course, we're always streaming on X at AJN Live. Share those links. Hit the like button. Help us to circumvent the algorithmic restrictions that still dog us daily. They still don't like us very much, despite all of the wonderful stuff that we're doing. Of course, you can follow me at Harrison H. Smith. We got a big show for you today. We're going to start with the trial of Carmelo Anthony. It's day two of the trial, and witnesses are taking the stand and are, of course, confirming that your assumptions were correct the entire time, or my assumptions were correct the entire time. And I assume everybody, like me, understood that from all of the evidence that was available the entire time, this was an unprovoked violent attack against an innocent person by a savage murderer who then lied about it. It's not that complicated, actually. It's pretty cut and dry, as far as I'm concerned. Now, I probably shouldn't even say this because my prediction has not come to fruition yet, but I remember predicting way, way back when it first happened that not only would Carmelo Anthony be shown to be the aggressor and the murder would be shown to be a cold-blooded attack, vicious, violent, and purposeful attack against an innocent person. That was always obvious from the beginning. But the way everything worked out, I always wondered if there wasn't going to be some sort of text message revealed or a witness taking the stand saying, yeah, Carmelo Anthony was going there looking for a fight. The way everything rolled out, the way, and still, as I read the witness testimonies, I think it becomes even more clear that, like, it seems to me like Carmelo Anthony went there to start a fight. You know, he wasn't running in the track race. He was actually suspended from school, and so he wasn't technically allowed to be at the track meet at all. So he wasn't going there to participate. He wasn't going there to support his own team because they would have had to send him home because he wasn't supposed to be allowed at school events. And he was suspended previously for another violent encounter. And I'm still waiting for it. It hasn't been revealed yet, but I still wonder if there's going to be some sort of piece of evidence presented that Carmelo Anthony was going there that day with a knife on purpose to start a fight. That hasn't been revealed yet, but basically everything up to that proves that Carmelo Anthony, of course, acted aggressively and without provocation. And so we have a lot of reports about this from a lot of different people. We'll start with Brianna Morello. She says, day two of the testimony in the Carmelo Anthony murder trial, the jury was shown a photo of the weapon used to kill Austin Metcalf. The photo was of a 5-inch folding knife with blood on it. Frisco police officer Jacob Schalls testified that he found the murder weapon Carmelo Anthony tossed. The knife was found 3 to 4 rows from where the crime took place. Schalls also located Anthony's backpack. Frisco officer Eduardo Cortez testified. When Carmelo Anthony heard Cortez say he had the alleged suspect over the police scanner, Anthony voluntarily said, I'm not alleged. I did it. He put his hands on me. I told him not to. The jury watched that camera, body camera footage. Frisco firefighter Neil Adams testified and stated that Austin Metcalf was gray and did not have a pulse when he responded. They did everything to save him. Adams got emotional on the stand and started tearing up. And it does sound like a highly emotional court proceedings for everybody involved. As Will Tanner puts it, at Will_Tanner_1, so the new civil rights hero of the John Brown and Nat Turner left was, 1, suspended from school and not supposed to be at the meet anyway, 2, showed up with a knife, 3, broke into another team's space for reasons that can only be presumed to be robbery, 4, was told to leave and refused, 5, stabbed the kid who was trying to do the right thing by his teammates and told him to leave. Yet his school let him graduate anyway. He's been out on bail, and all the prospective black jurors said they wanted to let him get away with it. And of course, we see the, as John Bound puts it, the circus that has arrived at the courthouse as well. And videos coming out of just the most, you know, despicable behavior by these people who never thought he was innocent. They never thought he was innocent. They never, you know, thought that this was a legitimate act of self-defense. There would be no reason for them to think that at all. They just sort of are claiming to believe that when in reality, it's pretty obvious. They're just happy that he killed a white kid. Like, they just think that's okay, and they think that's fine. And they keep saying that very loudly over and over. So we got a problem. We got a real big problem in this country. Continuing, Mary Ann Martinez I believe, is in the courtroom there for Daily Mail. She's the Texas Bureau Chief at Mariana Reports. She says, we're back in court for the afternoon session of the Carmelo Anthony trial. The judge has just asked the media not to identify upcoming witnesses who are minors. We were told the minors, we were not told who the minors are or what they will be testifying to. 17-year-old Memorial High School male athlete now testifying. We have been told not to give his name. He had been hanging out with Austin on the day of the stabbing. He runs track for Memorial. He was under the tent with Austin Metcalf. Teen is saying that several people confronted Carmelo Anthony and told him to leave the tent. Austin, another boy, and he were among the Memorial High School kids who told Anthony to leave. I remember it getting more aggressive, the teen said. I remember Carmelo refusing to leave, then Austin asked him to leave. Anthony said, touch me and find out, the boy recalled. Boy says Carmelo was asked to leave about 15 times by Austin and several others. He said no one ganged up on him, but he didn't think a fight was going to break out. He thought there was going to be minor pushing at most. Teen says this went on for 2 minutes and adds that both Austin and Carmelo were angry at this point. Boy says Carmelo was provoking Austin. Austin pushed Carmelo and then Carmelo stabbed him. He added the knife came from a backpack in Carmelo's lap. During the back and forth between Carmelo and Austin, Carmelo had his hands in the backpack, the boy said. After the stabbing, Carmelo threw the knife up the bleachers and then ran away. The boy said he didn't expect the stabbing at all. Quote, Austin fell onto the bleachers, onto his back, and then he got up and went against the fence and guardrail, and his chest was all bloody. He said, oh my God, the boy said. The boy called the ambulance at that point. Prosecutors asked the boy how hard Austin had pushed Carmelo Anthony. Boy said it was somewhere between a light shove and a hard shove. Hunter was at the bottom of the tent and was not involved in this. That's Austin's brother, Hunter. Boy denies anyone ganged up on Carmelo, which, of course, would be the only reason anybody would actually believe this was self-defense. When is anyone going to talk about the fact Carmelo Anthony was suspended from school and wasn't even allowed to be at the track meet? Again, Marianne Martinez, teen, is saying several people confronted Carmelo Anthony and told him to leave the tent. Austin, another boy, he was among the Memorial High School kids that told Anthony to leave. So it sounds like everybody in the tent was going, look, you got to leave, man. You're not supposed to be here. And finally, Austin sort of got up and tried to make him physically leave, and that's when Carmelo pulled out the knife and stabbed him. Again, an action that it just seems to me to indicate a like preparedness to do this. Like he went there with the knife, deliberately started a problem with people, sitting there holding the knife. He wasn't in any danger. He could have just left. I think he wanted to kill a person. That's my assumption of all of this. Nothing else makes any sense. The boy says Carmelo was provoking Austin. Austin pushed Carmelo and then Carmelo stabbed him. He added the knife came from a backpack in Carmelo's lap. He says, my friend's bleeding everywhere, the boy can be heard saying in a 911 call he placed. You can also hear lots of people shouting in the background in general chaos. Under cross-examination, the boy reveals that Carmelo Anthony wasn't even under the tent. He was sitting on the bleachers just above or north of the tent. What was the problem with that, the defense attorney asked, since Anthony wasn't under the tent. Relative area, the boy responds. He says they were told to keep kids from other schools away from the general area of their tent. Boy testifies that the exchange went on for about 2 minutes, Anthony arriving at the tent being asked to leave. When others asked Carmelo to leave and refused, Anthony became angry. Then both Austin and Carmelo became heated as the exchange went on. Under cross-examination, the boy was asked to show how the shove happened between Austin and Carmelo. Boy and defense attorney stand up and role-play the shove in front of the jury. Boy stated Carmelo is sitting on the bleacher with his hands in his backpack. Other kids are calling his bluff and saying he didn't have anything in his backpack. When Austin moves in to shove push Carmelo, Carmelo pulls the backpack from his knife and plunges it into Austin's chest. This was all part of the same motion. So again, these are some pictures of Carmelo. Carmelo Anthony taunted Austin Metcalf before the stabbing, according to prosecutors. Savannah Hernandez at Sav Says on X writes this. To give you an idea of how difficult it is to get into the courthouse for the Carmelo Anthony trial, one reporter told me she was waiting to get in since 4 a.m. There's a curfew imposed and no one is allowed to be on the courthouse grounds from 11 to 6, but she states people were waiting on the sidewalk near the courthouse as early as 4. Around 10 minutes before the curfew let up, officials allowed people to start lining up to get inside. Keep in mind that only select people are allowed inside the actual courtroom, but there's a separate room for media and other attendees where the trial is being streamed. Many Carmelo Anthony supporters have made sure to line up early, so they're the ones in these seats. During jury selection yesterday, I watched them take detailed notes regarding each potential juror as the selection process took place. There are only 27 seats in the alternate room, and strict media rules set in place for this trial restrict excess details from getting out as the trial progresses. So again, the fact that there are any Carmelo Anthony supporters at all should be troubling to you. Because once again, there is no indication whatsoever of any type from Carmelo Anthony or anybody else that this was anything other than a cold-blooded murder. So what you have is a bunch of people who are there going out of their way to go to this courthouse, getting there early to support a cold-blooded murderer. And they know that's what they're doing, and that's what they're doing. And they basically admit that. Which, again, is just absolutely and completely insane that any of these people live in this country. It's just completely nuts. And of course, how are they able to do this all day, every day, for a week on end? Oh, because they don't actually have jobs? Because actually the American taxpayer are literally funding these people to go antagonize white people at a murder trial of a white kid? Again, just utterly despicable. And they're also trying to dox the jury. Of course, there's a woman that was kicked out yesterday because she had gotten into the courtroom and was using her phone to try to take pictures of the jury, and they kicked her out and actually confiscated her stuff. And then she's running around going, they won't give me my purse back. It's like, well, you're trying to dox the jury to intimidate them to rig a trial because you know that a black person is innocent and you want him to get away with it. So I think you should go to jail, but taking your purse is a great middle ground. No black jurors chosen for Carmelo Anthony trial in fatal Texas track meet stabbing. And that's because the potential black jurors that were called and questioned admitted that they would be biased in favor of Carmelo Anthony because he's black. They literally said, we don't want to send another brother to prison. So you can't work on a jury. That's just how it goes. Yeah, the total jury pool was 600 people. Out of 600 people, they couldn't find a single black person that wouldn't be biased in favor of the cold-blooded, ruthless, stabbing murderer. The man at Carmelo Anthony murder trial saying the only good cracker is a dead cracker and that he'll push a cracker into the grave is Jacob Blake Sr. of Kenosha, Wisconsin, of all places. He has a documented history of anti-white and anti-Semitic statements on social media. His son, Jacob Blake Jr., was shot by police when they were trying to arrest him. It happened in 2020 when police were called out to a domestic disturbance call. The home of Lakeisha Booker, the mother of Jacob Blake Jr.'s children, Booker told dispatchers that Blake was not allowed on the property and had taken her keys and refused to return them. Officers arrived aware of an active felony arrest warrant for Blake issued in July 2020 on charges of third-degree sexual assault, trespassing, and disorderly conduct stemming from a prior domestic abuse attack involving the same woman. Body cam footage and witness video shows officers being attacked by Blake, officers ordering Blake to stop as he fought them. He ignored commands and moved toward an SUV. Police repeatedly yelled, drop the knife. Blake refused and turned towards an officer with a knife in his hand. The police shot him. He survived but was paralyzed from the waist down. The knife was recovered from the driver's side floorboard of the vehicle, and Blake admitted to possessing it. I think I remember this from back in 2020. Was this the guy? Were her children in the car? Was that this guy? He was like trying to steal her car with her children in it. Yeah, there was a video of it, I remember. Unless it was a different person. So again, this model citizen. Well, the whole family's obviously model citizens. The dad is out supporting a murderer. His son is routinely attacking police and violently attacking women. It's like, you know, what would we do without these people? And frankly, you know, we should be paying for everything for them. I mean, why should we expect these people to work and be productive? They're busy. They're obviously very busy. They're busy doing other things like beating up their baby mamas and supporting murderers at trial. So obviously we have to subsidize that as a society. We have to guarantee that they can actually do this on a full-time basis. Their entire lives should be dedicated to supporting criminals and demonizing white people, and the American taxpayer dollars should fund that. It does, routinely. I mean, not just through the individual welfare recipient of, you know, these types of people, but also the various NGOs that, of course, are set up to do this exact thing and fund this exact activity. Jacob Blake Sr. has since showed up at rallies and press conferences talking about systematic racism and police misconduct. Yeah, I bet. Yeah, I bet he has. In 2020 interviews, he focused on healing injustice for his son while criticizing the lack of charges. However, Facebook posts attributed to his account show repeated slurs against white people, crackers, pink toes. The hell? Is that a slur or a cute nickname? It's weird. Isn't it weird? Isn't that weird? You know, even cracker. Isn't that like whip cracker? Isn't that where that comes from? Or is it something else? And now people, I think, if it is like, you've never heard that slur? I think it's what it's cracker. It's like you're the, oh, pink toes. Yeah. Yeah. Whip cracker. It's like, okay, your slur for white people is to call them master. That's weird. Master and pink toes. It's like, that's cute. Those are cute. Thank you. And also claims about control of Jewish media, control of media and finance. He posted support for Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan, writing phrases such as "I'm with Farrakhan" and "A Jew can't tell me crap." Period. One stated, "One day pink toes will burn for real, for real." He is the same man causing a commotion and threatening white people outside of the Anthony murder trial. And of course, he's literally standing there in front of police saying, "I'm going to kill you. You all deserve to die." And I guess he's allowed to do that. I guess he's allowed to do that. Again, this is one of those things where it's like, he is allowed to do that. I don't want the police, you know, arresting people for saying even sort of outrageous things. I think you should be allowed to do that. I do. However, that's only really in a society where the people themselves are like intelligent and thoughtful and, you know, motivated by good things. Because then somebody going out and saying all crackers should die, the only cracker is a good cracker, all this sort of stuff, would be rejected by polite society. You wouldn't have to have police go in and stop that person, because ideally you would have a society that could recognize that some pregnant man, some pregnant black man wearing, you know, Africa, like a dashiki and a big Africa around his necklace saying kill all white people. Ideally, they should, on their own volition, push him away, but that's not happening. That's not happening. So what do you do with a society that embraces people like this, that embraces the really vicious, hateful rhetoric from these people that they're not shy about putting forward? And where are all the people out there that love to remind us that the Holocaust didn't start with burning Jewish people? It started with the dehumanization. Are we concerned about the rampant dehumanization of white people that's happening all over the world and at a, you know, aggressive clip and resulting in people like this basically making a career of running around antagonizing white people and causing problems? I think you should be deported. J.D. Miles says this about another prosecution witness. This prosecution witness' name is Jalen Matthews. He testified for the state. He's a former Memorial High School track star, now 19 years old. On first seeing Carmelo Anthony enter the Memorial High School tent, quote, "He comes in from the top of the bleachers and sits right next to me. It was a little suspicious, random kid. Just because he came out of nowhere with no friends, it raised heads. A lot of people are asking, who is this person? They were directly asking who he is. He, Austin, stood up and turned to him and said he had to get out of the tent. Never raises his voice. He, Carmelo, was serious and not moving at all. On how concerned they were with Carmelo in the tent, he just kind of had a stare into the field, and that's when it got more serious. Nobody is thinking anything like this is going to happen. On why Austin confronted Carmelo, Austin likes to step up for people. On what he witnessed, it was so quick I didn't really know what had happened. I saw him, Austin, lift up the shirt and the insides of the stabbing. Did it look like Austin was trying to pick a fight? No, sir. Did it look like Carmelo Anthony was trying to pick a fight? Yes, sir. Did this look like self-defense to you? No, sir. Was Carmelo Anthony the aggressor? Yes, sir." Again, I mean, it's as cut and dry as you can get. And it's as horrifying as you can imagine. These kids are going to run a track competition, probably hyper-focused on that, probably excited. It's early in the day. Some random kid wanders up. And, like, it's just insanity. It's just going from a totally normal, average, you know, whatever day to just brutal horror in the moment, in an instant, with no legitimate provocation, no warning that it was about to happen. Just one day you're like, can you please leave our tent? You know, one second you're saying, hey, man, this isn't your tent, man. You got to leave. And the next you're dying. And the next moment you're dead and your twin brother is kneeling at your side, howling in grief and praying to God to save you. It's just beyond brutal. And there you can see, if the crew can back up that video about 10 seconds, you can see sort of the absurdity of the defense's approach Oh, no. Can we back this up about 10 seconds? Because you can see the aerial shot of the tent, and you can see that, like, the tent is set up at the bottom of the bleachers, and then the immediate area of the bleachers, it has all the kids' stuff all over it. So the defense is going, but he wasn't actually under the tent, was he? But it's obvious from the, you know, aerial view, there's the tent, and then there's the bleachers immediately behind the tent, which is where actually most of the team will sit and stay and keep all of their stuff. So it's not like being under the tent or not being under the tent was that big of a difference. The tent denotes the area that the team is supposed to have. Like right there, you can see all the team's stuff is piled up on the bleachers right there because that's the team's area. So again, he wanders over. Wasn't allowed to be at the track event. Wasn't supposed to be there at all. Had been suspended from school for another violent incident. Shows up with a knife. Deliberately goes to provoke these people. Stabs Austin Metcalf in the heart. Throws the knife into the bleachers and runs away. But gets caught immediately. Again, I don't think he is like a criminal genius or anything. But I'm still operating under the assumption that this was first degree murder. I mean, this was pre-planned. This was not heat of the moment. This was not a big fight just getting out of hand. This was Carmelo Anthony probably being pissed off about other stuff and deciding he was going to go see if anybody would mess with him. And like, you know people like this. I know people. I have friends like this, right? They're in a bad mood. They'll just walk around looking for an excuse, right? Looking for somebody to run into them, looking for somebody to insult them so they can start something. I think that's what Carmelo Anthony was doing that day, and I think he went there on purpose with a knife to stab somebody. But he wanted it to be a fight first so he could claim self-defense. That's my assumption. The prosecution called a 17-year-old witness to the stand. Wersky cost the 17-year-old, if he likes to hold on to things in his hands when he gets nervous, the 17-year-old was holding a football in the stand, which he showed the jury. So this judge is just going to allow the witness to take a stand holding a football? Wow. This is Mr. Dennis Bryan, a black man, who is obviously very shocked and, you know, horrified that a 17-year-old kid would want to hold a football to ease his anxiety while testifying in a capital murder case. Wow. Wow. I can't believe it. Wow. This is so biased. This judge, he must be a racist or something. I mean, are they going to let the black kids hold their knives when they go up? You know, their comfort knives? Their therapy knives when they get up on the stand? Probably not. That's racism. So, you know, we'll bring any updates that arrive, but I mean, it's just going to be witness after witness, evidence after evidence showing Carmelo Anthony's a brutal murderer. That's it. Rumble.com/TheWarRoomLive. Rumble.com/TheWarRoomLive. It's how you find us directly. And of course, support us by going to TheAlexJonesStore.com. TheAlexJonesStore.com is the only way to support us. We make it incredibly easy for you to do so. It's 40 to 50% off site-wide right now. No discount code needed. All of the t-shirts, all of the hats, all of the hoodies, all of the supplements, of course, you're getting 40 to 50% off everything, including all apparel right now, TheAlexJonesStore.com. That sale ends tonight, so don't waste time. Go to TheAlexJonesStore.com/Harrison to let them know who sent you. It's also your last day to enter to win both the custom H1 Hummer and the 2026 Dodge Charger, plus $20,000 in cash. This is the last day, I believe. Yeah, this is the last day to enter to win both of these. So whatever you purchase at TheAlexJonesStore.com, you get basically an entry every penny you spend. So spend a dollar, you get 100 times entries. This week is usually the week when the winner makes his purchase. And of course, we've given away like over 20 of these cars so far. And somebody's got to win these. Could be you. All you got to do is go to TheAlexJonesStore.com and make a purchase. Count your lucky stars. TheAlexJonesStore.com. Support us. Keep us on the air. Keep us in the fight. And keep us telling the truth about things. Keep somebody out here telling the truth about stuff. And on that note, I want to go to clip number 9 here. This is a very interesting response to a very bad faith question about racism and the concept of racism and the lie of racism that is all predicated on lies. Let's go to clip number 9 here. I thought this was a very interesting and thorough and good faith response to a bad faith question. Let's watch. It says, POV, I want an actual racist person to explain to me why they're racist. audio.
A predictable response by pointing out genetic clustering or crime statistics or anthropology or black fatigue even, which most of us know about or are at least grappling with by now. I'd like to start by pointing out that the term racist is just an anti-white slur. What you may call racist is almost always just pattern recognition, or in its most innocent form, the simple preference of mating with people who look like you and share your cultural and ancestral history. Again, only whites are condemned for this. The word racist can technically be used to describe anyone, but effectively can only be utilized against white people. What is a so-called racist actually doing when he's being racist? Usually, it's making observations, and this is often framed as an irrational hatred, seeing that someone has more melanin than you and arbitrarily assigning a moral quality to that physical feature. This is a false premise, and it's important to reject this at its root. Race isn't really your skin color. It's a foundational component of your identity. It's an experience. Your identity is how you understand yourself and your relationship to the world around you, your beliefs, qualities, and expressions. These things directly inform what we're actually observing, which is cultural attitudes. According to Pew Research, 77% of blacks in America believe in some form of racial reparations. So in other words, the vast supermajority of black people believe that they are entitled to your money because of slavery that they didn't experience. On the other hand, only 18% of Americans, meaning white people, believe in reparations. These are two very contrary cultural attitudes that are directly informed by self-identified racial category. Why is this a problem? If there exists two groups with equal rights that possess societal grievances that conflict, one is going to have to trump the other. This necessarily means that one group's right will have to be ignored or even violated in favor of the others. So what's the takeaway? The term racist is just a fake linguistic spell invented by and propagated from a set of subversive actors to siphon resources from white people in favor of foreign groups that hate you. I'm glad that you have a black wife that you're super happy with, but this specific individual anecdotal experience does not represent the vast majority of interracial relations in the United States, and it certainly gives you no right to morally grandstand to people who simply use their eyes and ears to observe the brutal facts of this world that we live in. So to answer your question, I am a racist because you have been brainwashed into thinking that as a white man, my acknowledgement of reality should be labeled that way.
I think that's a great way to put it. You're not allowed to acknowledge reality as a white person. Yeah, more or less. But you really have to understand how absurd this concept is and how it has been implanted in our society. Now, racist, the term racist kind of has a funny history because it was originally written, like it was made up, the term racist was made up by a person to define themselves. Basically, it must have been the 1910s or 20s, it was some French guy, I can't remember who it is, but this is when sort of the concept of nationalism was rising, and he basically came up with this term saying, you know, I actually want to think about things in terms of race, I'm a racist, but it only got into common parlance, and only became a sort of negative term and used as a pejorative when there's a book called, I believe it was called Racism, by Magnus Hirschfeld, I believe it was, who of course was the doctor in Weimar Germany that performed the first transgender surgeries there. So it's kind of interesting that the person that both brought it may have been Gaston Laval who originally came up with it, but racism as a negative term, as in a negative context, was popularized by the same guy that popularized transgender surgery. So might be some interesting connections to be made there. But regardless, you know, I still to this day think the best way to think about what racism, the term really is think about if they came out tomorrow with the term saying familyist and said it is the worst thing you could possibly do. The worst thing you could possibly do, the worst thing you could possibly be is a familyist. How dare you value your family over another, because that's all the race is. It's an extended family. It's all the nation is. It is an extended family. The word nation shares the same root as the word nature. It is the Latin root word for birth, right? Natal comes from it as well. It's about your birth. It's about your family. It's about your condition. Yeah, Racism by Magnus Hirschfeld, the transgender doctor in Weimar, Germany. Really interesting stuff, huh? So the idea of racism is kind of absurd on the face of it, in the same way that a familyism would be absurd. And that is, again, the way you need to think about it. Because if I ask you, you know, who do you value more, your daughter or somebody else's? It's actually natural and good and right. Quiet, kid. It's actually good and right to value your kid over other people. Does that mean that you hate every other family because you have a familial connection to your children, your wife, your parents? That means that you somehow want every other family to be destroyed and that you think your family has a right to rule over other family? Like, what are you talking about? That is insane. But that's what's extrapolated from, hey, I'm white. I like white people. I want white people to do well. They're just like, really? Is that so, sir? It's like, what the hell? It's crazy. It is crazy. And it's taken, you know, 100 years of deliberate, persistent propaganda to get us to this point. Yeah, an essay on the inequality of the human races. It's a racialist work of French diplomat and writer author De Gobineau. It argues there are intellectual differences between human races, that civilizations decline and fall when races are mixed and the white race is superior. It is considered to be an influential example of early scientific racism. So he created the word racist, but then Magnus Hirschfeld wrote a book about how wrong and bad and evil it is. But then obviously no other race of people is even expected to appropriate any of this stuff about race. Like, literally nobody cares if Jewish people support Jewish people or black people support black people. I care in the sense of the hypocrisy. I care because it's not born out of a general, you know, goodwill towards all men, but also I'm black, so I like black people too, and I understand them. It doesn't come from – it's not a general goodwill. It is a insider-outsider paradigm that they work on. It's more accurate. That is more accurate. Thank you, crew. So, what is racism actually? You know, it's similarly the absurdity of calling anybody that's not white a minority. When if you look at the globe, if you look at the earth, white people are a vanishingly small minority, something like 7% of the world's population. A staggering decline from the 30% of the world population white people represented a couple hundred years ago, or 100 years ago, a little bit more, before World War I, essentially. And so you've got this just like assumption that Europe just owes everybody else everything else, and Europeans owe everything to everybody else. And again, we can explore this forever, and people have, but still, to this point, people still think that, like, calling somebody a racist is and should be the worst thing you could ever call somebody. And the whole thing is just, it just doesn't make any sense. It's just meaningless. It's nothingness. If there were actually, you know, vicious racists out there, well, even then, I mean, it just doesn't exist. So, like, why entertain the possibility of something happening when it's not actually happening? What's actually happening is that the vast majority of people labeled racist are in fact just white people who are defending themselves. Yeah, and then you look at the actual stuff that the actual left-wingers, like this was written by a Jewish person for the Smithsonian, Assumptions and Aspects of Whiteness and White Culture in the United States. And it's basically everything good. It's everything good and lovely and powerful and positive. It's rugged individualism. It's the family structure. It's an emphasis on the scientific method, history, Protestant work ethic, future orientation, aesthetics, religion, status, power, authority, time, competition, justice, holidays, communication. It's like everything good. Again, it's not that complicated, folks. They say whiteness is evil. What is whiteness? All the things that make an individual strong, all the things that make a family strong, all the things that make you confident and capable and able to resist coercion and pressure from outside forces. It's everything that makes you less able to be controlled, they label as whiteness, and have everybody in the country demanding its abandonment because they consider it evil because it's whiteness. Again, the individual is the primary unit, self-reliance, independence, and autonomy being highly valued and rewarded. The nuclear family. The family structure. This is whiteness, and it must be destroyed. The nuclear family. Father, mother, 2 to 3 children is the ideal social unit. Husband is breadwinner and head of household. Wife is homemaker and subordinate to the husband. Children should have their own rooms and be independent. So, I mean, literally, what that describes there, those four bullet points, are the answer to how do you make the most successful, prosperous, and happy people in the world? How should we organize our family structure so that people turn 18 and are capable and loved and supported and powerful? How do we do that? You follow the whiteness instructions, actually. You actually do what they say white people traditionally do, because white people created the best societies through trial and error. Those practices, the best ones, become what we call tradition, and a bunch of psychotic third worlders are trying to destroy it and tear it all down rather than just follow the instructions as laid out, because the instructions themselves are being labeled as white supremacy and rejected on that basis. I mean, literally, that like, what is whiteness chart, you could change the title to, like, what is greatness, what is power, you know, what it, like, individual power, not power over other people, but power to resist other people. It's literally whiteness. Okay. So basically all the anti-whiteness really all does come from like jealousy and envy at the end of the day. That's why they all want to move here. That's why they all do move here. Do you know that 25% of Mexicans live in America and 70% of them are on welfare? That's the latest number from the from an institute that studies this stuff. 25% of Mexico, this is White Papers Policy Institute. We have been the most generous country in the world to our detriment. 25% of all Mexicans live in the U.S. 70% of them rely on welfare. 10% of Guatemalans live here. 77% of them are on welfare. 12% of Nicaraguans live in America. 75% of them are on welfare. 12% of Haitians live here. 53% rely on our welfare. I'll say, you know, have you ever read the story Harrison Bergeron by Kurt Vonnegut? It describes a dystopian future where everyone has to be equal, and that means that the strongest and smartest people have to have, they have to be disabled, basically. If you're too smart, they make you wear an earpiece that distracts you constantly, or if you're too strong, they make you wear a weighted vest to slow you down. America's Harrison Bergeron. The immigrants, so 25% of Mexico lives in America. They're taking our jobs, but they're also living on welfare to the tune of 70%. So just like, picture America without all of this crap. Can you even imagine what America would be like without all this crap, without the endless burden of foreign peoples relying on us, or foreign wars for foreign powers that benefit us not at all, or the people here that live off welfare generation upon generation? I mean, could you imagine? So like, think about the fact that 50% of all jobs created, I think that was a number, could have been worse, at least 50% of all jobs created since like 2004 have gone to foreigners. 90% of new jobs created since COVID have gone to foreigners. Tens of millions of foreigners are living here on either, you know, fake visas, fake IDs, not paying into Social Security. They're taking our jobs. Again, 50% of them since 2004, 90% since COVID. They're also all living on welfare. They're also scamming welfare that we see in the Somali community, in the Indian community, $90 billion or whatever it is. Then you've got the money being sent back to Mexico, not getting taxed. Then you've got, again, the welfare just of Americans here that intergenerationally subsist entirely on taxpayer money. And it's just like and yet, folks, most people in America don't even think anything's wrong. They think we aren't being stolen from enough. It's crazy how powerful we are. It's crazy how productive we are. And it's insane that we don't benefit from it. That we haven't benefited from it, that it has all been stolen from us. And the saddest part about this is that other countries are laughing at us. We can go to clip 6 here. This is on Chinese TV. is infuriating, but I got to say he's got a point here. Let's go to clip number six now. I'll read along. He says, California's high-speed rail was promised, but not 1 kilometer was built. In the 80s, he says, I visited the U.S., high-speed rail was proposed. We didn't even have highways yet. I thought impressive, but nothing came of it, for many reasons. In Chinese terms, no party leadership, no political structure representing the people's overall interest, drive from France into Germany. The signs are different. Germany has no speed limits. France has very strict speed limits. We just visited Serbia. China helped build the line to Hungary. The Serbia section is complete. The standards are interesting. It's 200 kilometers an hour, but reserve options upgrade to 250 kilometers high-speed rail. In Hungary, that section is 160 kilometers per hour and can't change. It's strictly EU standards. You mentioned Chinese rail doesn't profit. Recouping construction costs through fares could take very long. But what it drives is the flow of people, traffic, and information, all movement and its impact on society. And the economy is immeasurable. So I think we always calculate the total account, what you said, back to party leadership about overall interest. What we calculate is look to the General Secretary's economic thinking, he interrupts. There's a point about supply also creating demand. Don't overthink construction. Construction. Once the highway exists, the arteries open up, and now demand emerges naturally. China, for example, built many roads in rural areas, great infrastructure. Some felt it wasn't economically justified, but conversely, building that transport raised the economic value of those areas. Transport brings life to that place. Also, undertaking large-scale public infrastructure requires long-term investment and patient waiting. As you said at the start, planning takes time and enormous funding, but these reflect our system's strengths. That time, if placed in the West, or that massive investment left to private enterprise, would they invest? That's the difficulty. But because transport infrastructure typically runs long cycles, facing huge risks in many areas, it simply can't move forward. Public means everyone has a share. You should enjoy convenient, fast quality service. But in the U.S., public really just means a safety net. In many sectors, so-called public provision tends to be low quality in education, in healthcare, and likely in transport to a degree too. As I said before, though contrast you feel how valuable socialism is, the superior of socialism is clear. Socialism forwards, very valuable. Also mentioned, our integrated transport network strongly emphasizes serving the people, ensuring ordinary people genuinely feel real tangible gains. People are thrilled to hear high-speed rail is coming to their hometown. Before, it didn't seem to matter whether high-speed rail came or not. Not everyone feels it. My country has it too. That feeling is completely different. So again, they're laughing at us. While Japan's bullet trains have been running since 1964, United States just proved the first mile of true high-speed track 62 years later. And of course, in California, they spent literally tens of billions of dollars and built nothing. They spent tens of billions of dollars and built nothing with it. Is that capitalism? I don't think so. Capitalism, you don't spend money if there's not a return to it. You can't get access to billions of dollars of funds without proving your worth first, because the people who give you money, it's their money and they're concerned about where they're giving it. And they're only going to give it if you have a proven track record of an ability to do what you say you're going to do. When it's the government money, then tens of billions of dollars can go missing and nobody will even notice. Do you think that he talks about visiting America in the 80s and we were talking about high-speed rail and he was impressed. Now China has this massive high-speed rail network. At the time, in the 1980s, China didn't even have highways. Now it's got incredible highways, it's got incredible airports, it's got incredible high-speed rail systems. America has utterly failed to create anything, basically, since the 1980s. Is that because we've become more capitalistic since the 80s? Is that because our government has incrementally and increasingly become more socialist or less socialist? No, the difference is nationalism. It's not the system that matters as much. Russia also has amazing subway systems and trains. They're not communists. and yet they're maintained and built, you know, in a much better way than we have. Japan obviously has no communism, and you could literally eat off the floor in any subway station in Tokyo because it's just that clean and well produced. It's nationalism at the end of the day. It's people who actually see their fellow Americans as their extended family members and want to work together to uplift everybody, that don't see every opportunity as an excuse to screw everybody over. Like, think about the fact that in Seattle, the socialist mayor that just got elected has come out and announced that she is not interested and will not be pursuing any claims of fraud against the Medicaid, Medicare industry, even though it's been presented to her that there are, you know, ethnic minorities like Indians or Somalians who are filing false reports and screwing the system for millions of dollars. She says, I don't care. I think that's racist and I'm not going to investigate it. So my question is to you, what is the smart thing to do here? What is the smart thing to do here? In reality, the smart and immoral thing to do is to take that as a green light and start scamming the system relentlessly. I mean, what do you do when the mayor says, hey, millions of dollars might be stolen from the government, but I'm not looking into it. I will not be investigating theft. I will not be investigating fraud. I mean, you can either sit back and let all the Somalis make off with the tens of millions of dollars, or you can start up your own clinic and start filing invoices and getting money. Like, that's what happens when you have these people in power. They don't care about fraud. They don't see it as a bad thing when tens of billions of dollars get misappropriated. We are spending infinite amounts of money and giving away infinite amounts of jobs to hostile foreigners who are bankrupting us completely, totally. We have gone, no pun intended, totally off the rails since the 1980s. And it's nationalism that will get us back. It's a care for our nation.
Let's talk about the feminization of our institutions. You're incredibly concerned about the great feminization's impact on the legal profession, in particular, the rule of law. Why?
Because I think that the feminization of the law will tend to make our grown-up legal system look more and more like the Title IX courts that we had for sexual assault on college campuses, which removed due process protections because who was going to benefit from them? Men. And they were probably all rapists anyway, so who cares? Mm. And then some of the court cases that arose out of the Me Too movement also violated some really important due process protections. I think there were huge flaws in the Harvey Weinstein New York court case, which is why the New York Court of Appeals later overturned that conviction, because mm-hmm. there were so many problems with that court case and so many instances of due process that were violated. It was as if we all decided that Harvey Weinstein was a bad guy, therefore he needed to be in jail regardless of what the actual legal outcome, whether the prosecution proved their case or not. Mm-hmm. And this is the area of the essay that I've gotten the most pushback on. I say that, you know, even the liberal lady lawyers that I know have the utmost respect for the rule of law. And that's true. And, of course, there are lots of really great, capable female lawyers. But my response would be this. If you are looking for examples of female lawyers saying clearly for the record, I don't care what the law says, I'm going to follow my feelings, you will be unlikely to find examples of that happening, even in cases where that is transparently clearly what's going on. The example I would offer is Sarah Koenig, who is the Serial lady, the Serial podcast mm-hmm. lady. Mm-hmm. When Adnan Syed's murder conviction was overturned, briefly, it's back now, but when it was overturned, it was on procedural grounds. The women who were working so hard on his behalf to exonerate him found some failures of the prosecution to disclose certain items of evidence, and it was on that basis that his conviction was briefly overturned. So if you asked those lawyers who brought that motion to exonerate Syed what they were doing, they would have said, we are adhering to the rule of law. But I listened to the Serial podcast, and it is very clear to me that it is not out of concern for the rule of law that the true crime podcast listening middle-aged women of America convinced themselves that this poor guy was actually innocent, even though all of the evidence in the case pointed in his direction. It really was emotional. It was, and you can hear Sarah Koenig say this on the Serial podcast. She says, "I don't think he did it because he seems like a nice guy. He doesn't seem like a psychopath. I've seen him show emotion toward me." Come on, lady. And of all the various corruptions of the rule of law, coddling violent criminals would have to be the one that poses the greatest threat to, you know, your listeners, to you and me living here in Washington, D.C. It's a huge problem.
Right.
People being unwilling to enforce the rule of law on people who are threats to public safety, right? So
it's just a denialism that is very apparent in that
podcast.
That's right. I don't want to believe that this person that I had a normal conversation with could murder me violently. Because what does that mean for your safety? Whether you're a man or a woman, but particularly if you're a woman, mm-hmm. what does that mean for your public safety if this guy that you can have a pleasant conversation with over the phone from jail could murder you?
Although, let me throw a twist in this story. Sarah Koenig's stepfather, who I think married her mother when she was 10 or 11 years old, so who raised her, was also a famous writer, Peter Matheson, whose work may be known to some listeners. He's very famous, very, very accomplished writer, very good guy. But he did the same thing. He was the most passionate advocate for Leonard Peltier, the Native American activist who was pardoned sort of wrongly, I think, by Joe Biden on like his last week in office.
That guy who
shot an FBI agent point blank in the head. But he came to Peter Matheson with some sob story saying, "Oh, it wasn't me. I was there, but I didn't shoot him." And Peter
All right, Matheson that's Helen said, oh. Andrews. Helen Andrews. You find that on X as well. We'll be right back with more. Stay with us, folks. It's War Room Live, AlexJonesLive.com. The Henry Novak case continues to dominate headlines, good, as it should. J.D. Vance has even come out with a lengthy response to the, you know, revelation of the body cam footage and so much more. I think he's exactly right. And this is the type of thing that stops me from totally throwing J.D. Vance, like, under the bus. I know a lot of people, you know about his... the path he took to get to where he is, and are very suspicious about it. I am too. His connections with Peter Thiel, his changing his name so much. But then he comes out with something like this, and it's like, thank God we have J.D. Vance in the halls of power. We need somebody like this, somebody saying the obvious, right? J.D. Vance says this: Henry Novak died the same way a civilization dies, abandoned, handcuffed by authorities who neither trusted nor cared for him, and accused of hate crimes he did not commit. His murder is as tragic as it is enraging. He should still be alive today, and he would be if the last few generations of European elites had stood their ground against the politics of self-hatred and the mass invasion of migrants, many of whom despise the West and the people who love it. Henry was far from the first to so needlessly lose his life, and I fear he won't be the last. Each time a life like his is lost, the proper response, the only response, is righteous anger. One of the most important things the Trump administration has proven to the world is that stopping the flow of mass migration and defending national sovereignty is a matter of political will and leadership. Anything else is an excuse. It's because we love the West that we want to preserve it. We love our civilization. We love our country. We love our children. And nobody should ever die the way that Henry Novak died. May God comfort those who loved him, and may God rest his soul. So again, I think this is an amazing thing for the Vice President of the United States to acknowledge and to write. And to hopefully operate off of. Hopefully this isn't just a rhetorical flourish. Hopefully it's backed up by genuine belief and ideology and political action to undergird it. The thing is, and this is what I find myself often explaining and trying to get across, but put simply, we have a system that is made for people in good faith, people who, on their own volition and without being forced to, will do the right thing because they know that it benefits everybody to behave that way. That system is beautiful. It's good. It's positive. It is the outcome of thousands of years of trial and error and war and bloodshed. And the West, as people put it, aka Christendom, aka Europe and the European diaspora, aka white people, created a system as better than anyone has ever existed, that, you know, any other system that's ever existed in the world. The problem is it's vulnerable. It can be taken advantage of. So to preserve this system, you have to ruthlessly guard it. It's not that complicated. And there's a people get confused, I think, because inside the system, we have these vulnerabilities. We have this ability for people to sort of, you know, use it as they will and, you know, adhere to it or not as they want. I mean, we're a little loosey-goosey with that. But that's for people in our system. That's for us. That's for people within our system. And we talk about this all the time. Like, you can't write laws to deal with every instance of every event. It's not possible. It's why we have courtrooms. It's why we have lawyers to make these arguments, why we have juries to make these decisions, because you can't mathematically determine the outcome of absolutely everything, despite the globalist, you know, desire to have us all operate like, you know, chips on a computer board. That's not how the world is. So laws are written, but there's some interpretation required, and there's some leniency provided in some cases, and, you know, more strictness in others. But at the end of the day, it's a human endeavor that we're engaged in. And so in order to maintain this system of vulnerability, you have to ruthlessly guard it. It's not that common. It's why Camp of the Saints is named Camp of the Saints. If you've heard about this book, it's made a big resurgence recently, and it's a good book, and sort of terrifying how sort of accurately it portrayed the modern world. But essentially, it's a fantasy. It's a dystopian novel that was written decades ago, and it was looking into a future where basically boatloads of people from the third world start arriving in Europe. And the whole beginning of the book explains the name Camp of the Saints, that basically it's like Europe is a walled garden. And that, or a camp of saints, right? With no wall, with no defense, but with beauty and vulnerability and precious people, precious items, but extremely vulnerable to attack from the outside. The Camp of the Saints is describing Europe. It's another name for Europe. And you could call it the Garden of the Saints, right? Or the Walled Garden of Europe. And you have to protect it, because if you don't, it's extremely easy to take advantage of. One of the main examples of this was revealed recently, where it was revealed that a bunch of immigration NGOs in Britain were training the immigrants to say that they were gay so that they wouldn't be deported back to their country that executes gay people. These people would come along with their families and children and claim to be gay and persecuted because they're gay. So, you know, personally, because, you know, I don't even necessarily think that's, but it's sort of like the ultimate example of our system. And whether you think it's an appropriate thing or not, that is the type of stuff that white people do, that Westerners do, that Christians do, that Europeans do, that they say, look, we understand, we, even if we don't agree with it, we understand that you have this immutable characteristic you were born with, and it's wrong for people to punish you. And if your country is going to punish you for that, then we will protect you from that. It's kind of a beautiful thing. And I know some people, it's like a lot of people are just like, no, that's just us being idiots. Maybe. But I think like the value of our system is that we do make allowances for, you know, people that don't fit in to their prescribed position. Yeah, 1973 is when Camp of the Saints came out. And again, people think it's like we have this system that is very liberal, very loosey-goosey, and we don't treat people very harshly most of the time. At least, you know, theoretically we shouldn't, which is good. But then you do have to treat people harshly who are on the outside of the system, that are trying to break the system, that are trying to destroy the system. You can only maintain a system of vulnerabilities if you ruthlessly punish taking advantage of those vulnerabilities. Really not that complicated, okay? If you want to have a system of asylum, you have to ruthlessly punish anybody that tries to claim asylum but doesn't deserve it. It's the only way to continue to have an asylum system. The only way you can have just any system that's not, you know, mechanized and mechanical and technological, where you're, you know, everything is just sort of a calculation. If you have any sort of human nuance in it, you have to ruthlessly protect it against anybody who will exploit it. And that's not being mean to those people. That's being nice to the people that enjoy the system. It's upholding the system that's so wonderful, you have to be ruthless and brutal for anybody that tries to destroy that system. Again, I don't know how hard it is for people to understand this. Let's go to clip number 7 here. This is a young man at the Henry Novak protest in the UK. He gets it, obviously, and it's just yet another example of yet another random British person who you just think, how many of these people can this island produce? How many people who are just so intelligent, so thoughtful, such good people at their heart? You know, it's like we had Frank Wright on the other day, and when that video went viral, I retweeted it just saying they're just geniuses walking around out there. They're just absolute geniuses walking around, and their genius is not being put to use to better the society. They're not the ones in charge of things so that things work well. They're deliberately excluded from everything because of who they are, because of their skin color. So as bad as it is in America, with half of our jobs since 2004 going overseas to, you know, half of Central and South America living here and collecting welfare. In Britain, for every one British person hired, 27 foreigners have gotten jobs. So they are being just deliberately and very rapidly excluded from their own society. And, you know, it's not going to kill them in a generation, but it'll take two or three. But yeah, you know, you can't find a job. It's hard to, you know, get a wife and have kids if you can't support yourself, can't afford to go out on dates. Certainly, even if you get married, it's hard to have the confidence of having a kid if you're like barely keeping your head above water as it is. And so it's like families that would otherwise, if the father had gotten gainfully employed immediately after school, they would have had 5 kids. Maybe they have 2 instead of 5. And then maybe those 2 kids, you know, only have 1 at the end. And then within 2 or 3 generations, it's just over completely. It's not a typical genocide. It's not a Gaza-style genocide where they're dropping bombs on people or shooting them when they come to get food. It is a more subtle but almost more effective form of genocide where they just make it that much more inconvenient to exist, that much more difficult to grow, that much more difficult to save money, that much more difficult to maintain the land that your forefathers fought and died for and cultivated in the first place. Just a little bit more difficult generation after generation, and before you know it, you look around and your country's gone. So I'm glad to see people in Europe, you know, starting to stand up and speak out against this. But there's almost this bittersweet thing when you see these videos of these great, just genius UK people, and you just go, these are the people that should be running the country, that in the past would have been running the country, which is why Britain became how great it was and still is to a certain degree. But now they're all just being excluded deliberately because of who they are and because they're smart, because they're capable, because they're nationalistic, because they can see through the lies. That's why they're kept out, because they're not playing along with the game. They're not willing to sell out their own people, and they're not willing to, you know, bend the knee to whatever international power demands it. So we gotta wake up and seize control again once and for all. Let's go to clip number 7 here. This is a young man at the Henry Novak protest. Let's watch.
What motivated you to attend this protest today for Henry Novak?
So I'm 17, which means that most of us who are young know that we have years ahead of us, or at least we're arrogant in that respect because we believe we're in a safe country. So having seen someone who's 18 years of age, his last words probably being the rights being read out to him by the police, there's very small thing, that there are very big things that would have to make me cry, but seeing that footage really did.
What does Henry Novak's death mean to you personally? Why is it important?
Well, it's important because it represents the two-tier policing system that we have. That Sikh family knew what to say to the police. They knew what to prompt to the police in order for them not to be investigated for the slashers and he's back, which meant that we currently live in a migration system where we have generations of migrants who shouldn't be here but have been here and learn how to trick the system.
What specific concerns or questions do you feel have been adequately addressed or not adequately addressed by the government at present?
So besides from the investigation of the actual officers who committed the arrest and why they did it, and the lack of sufficient training that they probably received, especially surrounding the circumstances of an allegation of racism, mm-hmm. followed up with someone, you know, being hurt. Mm-hmm. The fact that we had the body cam footage released, I was surprised about. The fact that we do have some of them even resigning before making statements of what happened was a good thing. It's not that what people did in response wasn't a good thing. It was that the system is already set against us.
What changes or actions are you hoping will result from this protest, which is now actually a march?
We have a wider discussion on re-migration, a wider discussion of the actual long-term impacts of mass migration. Because so far it's confined to talking about the 1% of radical Islamists or, you know, sort of radical terrorists. Now it can be broadened up to migrants and, for example, their ceremonial daggers they may have. The fact that there are generations of migrants, despite the fact that some of them, quite rightfully, should have stayed in this country, most of them shouldn't.
Now, it's a fact that the perpetrator of this crime was Sikh. And he was actually obsessed with knives. He had many knives at home. But the actual murder weapon, which has been released in a picture by Southampton Crown Court, by the Crown Prosecution Service, wasn't actually a kirpan. How significant do you actually think it is that he was a Sikh? Or do you think it was just a tragic accident that could have happened to anyone?
Look, so from my understanding, it was used, but the weapon actually killed him was a significantly large dagger. Now, symbolically, if we have equality under the law, unless everyone and every tribe of people is allowed a knife, there isn't an exclusive one group that should have it. Now, his obsession of knives could have spun from the fact he had it on him constantly, and it was taught from at birth to be a good thing, a defensive thing, because Sikhs always taught that their religion is incredibly pious because it came out of the 15th century in a defence against radical Islamism. So, because we've been sold this narrative that the Sikhs are incredibly peaceful people and that the Sikhs only use it in a defensive capacity,
Of course he could have, but would you not say on the broad majority of the cases that they do use it defensively? Is this not an edge case?
Well, it's like if we had the Second Amendment exclusively for one ethnic group of people or one religious group of people. I don't even think people who are pro-Second Amendment in America would say it's only for European settlers who settled in their country because they fought for the rights. So if we have a right to bear arms, if we have a right to knives, it shouldn't be exclusive to one group of people. Because then it causes the negative impact of course, putting a group up on the pedestal, then causing this unnecessary criticism of these groups of people. If everyone had a knife, the Sikhs wouldn't have been critiqued as a community. It would have just been this one lad.
And lastly, what would you like people who are not at this protest, which is now actually turned into a march if you look behind us, what would you like people to understand about why this issue matters?
It matters because people only care until it actually happens. And when it happens, it's devastating. The Henry Novak family only cared about issues, you know, surrounding their own personal safety after the boy's been stabbed. People in Southampton only care about the effects of mass migration or the effects of having a bladed article until it happens to them. So realise about long-term impacts.
Cheers, man.
So again, just, you know, extremely well said. Obviously, you know, the youth get it. I am a little bit, different than this. This is a video I'm looking for. You know, it's interesting. He says, you know, you shouldn't have one group of people able to arm themselves, and he uses the Second Amendment as an example. You wouldn't have, you know, just Europeans in America having guns. But why not? But why not is the question. Young Bob is this young man's name. Young Bob RB on X. Very well-spoken man. Oh, he's pretty popular. Okay. Hope Not Hate. Oh, arguably the best known of the batch. Okay. I was like, wait, he's not a part of Hope Not Hate. No, he's targeted by Hope Not Hate. Yes, that makes a lot more sense. A lot more sense. I'm going to have to follow him. Young Bob RB. Very powerful stuff. But I always do think it's funny to make the suggestion that black people shouldn't be allowed to have guns. I think that's funny. because what is the argument against it? What is the argument? How do you argue against that without undercutting the entire anti-gun argument? Where you go, well, if you take guns away from black people, they'll be helpless. They'll be defenseless. It's like, okay, so you want to take guns away from everybody? How does that make any sense? It doesn't make any sense. It's, if you think this is such a good thing, then wouldn't it be a good thing if at least a part of the portion, you know, a portion of the population had to adhere to it? Wouldn't that be a positive thing? Abortion would be another one, right? Can we have abortions for black people only? Would that be acceptable? No? Well, why not? I thought abortions were great and good. Because to be racist against white people, denying them abortions, don't they deserve it? I mean, white people, they're bad, right? They've done bad things in the past. We should punish them by not letting them get access to abortion. But the irony is that in the UK, that's exactly how it is. Literally, there are not just Muslim patrols that are allowed to run around with weapons. There's the Jewish group Shamrin that is a fake police force. They wear police uniforms and carry around guns and drive police cars around, but they're not the police. They're a Jewish private militia. They're allowed to carry guns. Like in Australia, the Jewish militia is allowed to carry guns. Nobody else is. This is a crazy video out of the UK. Driftwood at Buck97552 on X wrote, when armband wearing Muslim Sharia patrols are riding through Manchester streets on horseback while DEI indoctrinated police stand there watching, paralyzed with fear and indecision, something has gone badly wrong. A government that can tax, regulate, and monitor every aspect of your life yet is unable to enforce its authority on the street is exhibiting hallmarks of anarcho-tyranny. The moment people lose faith that the law is applied equally to all, the state's legitimacy starts to erode. Britain has arrived at a very dangerous place. Let's watch this video. These are the Muslim Sharia patrols wearing armbands and patrolling Manchester on horseback. Let's watch.
Apparently, they're allowed to chase people with horses.
And there's the police standing there. The lady police.
They just chase someone with an horse.
Yeah, it's fine.
They just chase people with horses.
Yeah, that's great.
Hey, part of Greater Manchester Police. How come they're not being nipped for chasing them people with horses then? They've just been chasing people with horses, officer. They've been chasing people with horses.
Yeah, so again, Sharia patrols. And we've seen it. Remember, we saw the video last week. Young woman in the UK sitting on a bench waiting for a train when two Muslim men wearing high-vis vests, looking like the police, but they're not police, walk up and start telling her that she has to leave because she's not dressed appropriately or whatever it is. And she's sitting there filming them going, who are you? And they're going, don't worry about who we are. You have to leave now. They're just random dudes wearing high-vis vests. This is what they're allowed to do in the UK. They have sovereignty. You don't. That's how it works. There was a Muslim dude who was fighting police at the airport, broke the police officer's nose. Woman police officer punched her in the face, broke her nose. He got totally released. No charges whatsoever. Meanwhile, a 21-year-old boy is going to be sentenced to 3 to 5 years in prison for throwing a traffic cone in the direction of police. This is from Russia Garbage Human on X. 21-year-old son pleads guilty to throwing traffic cone at police. The cone didn't even hit the police. It's the same judge that oversaw the Southport riot, you know, free speech imprisonments. It was all done via telelink. 3 to 5 years sentencing guidelines, immediately remanded to custody. Justice, in quotes, in 72 hours because he isn't brown, Muslim, or a lefty. If only he broke a policewoman's nose instead or raped a working class English girl, then he wouldn't be sent to prison for 3 years. 21-year-old son pleads guilty to throwing cone in the direction of police. This is by the mother, saying, just sat in Portsmouth Magistrate Court and watched my son plead guilty to throwing a traffic cone, which was caught on camera from the disturbance at Southampton on Tuesday over two-tiered policing and the poor boy's death at the hands of the police. I don't condone violence towards the police, but my son is only 21 and got caught up in the moment. He informs me he didn't even hit them, just threw it towards them. Firstly, it was a kangaroo court. The solicitor informed me before entry that it would be in the district crown court judge that oversaw the Southport rioters court case, presiding with what appeared on a big screen once my son came up from the cells, took his a guilty plea and then informed him by video link, with it being such a high-profile case, his guilty plea with the sentencing guidelines somewhere between 3 to 5 years for guilty. With that said, he's remanding him in custody, and he'll be sentenced Sunday morning at Southampton.
We assure you this mystery is all but unsolvable. No witnesses, no murder weapon, the whole place wiped clean.
Unsolvable. Ha! In fact, I've already worked out who's done it.
But we've only been here 28 seconds.
Oh, my dear Watson. Did you notice the tiny indent in the floor? Its shape and size indicates it could only have been made by a loose shoelace cap that had been stepped on. Specifically, cap model number 31882B, which only comes with the laces of the work boots issued as part of the standard uniforms at the local meatpacking plant, which the local butcher was a former employee of. The very same butcher who can't tie his shoes on account of his fingertips being gone. Motive? He harbored hatred against the store owner, part of a rival family in his home country, Italy.
Ah, it was me. Blast, you've done it.
Elementary, indeed.
Now, how do we solve this one? There was no one about and no weapon here either.
Ha! Oh, dear Watson, you haven't noticed, have you?
What?
Look up. Do you see the light glass casing around the lantern?
Of course.
You see the victim's scream reverberated off the brick and up the lamp, causing it to shimmy ever so slightly against its casing. By noting which etchings are most fresh, correcting for standard noise levels through the day, and the effect photons would have on the reverberation, I can work out a formula that would allow me to construct a perfect image of who the sound waves bounced off of that night.
Incredible!
Oh, it was me. Blast, you've done it.
All right, we're impressed. But we've got one more case for you, Sherlock.
We found a 15-year-old girl with her head cut off. It appears some kind of grooming gang kidnapped her and forced her into slavery before murdering her. People near the scene of the crime heard them scream Allahu Akbar when the incident occurred.
I mean, that could have been anybody. Anybody could have done that.
There must be clues. What did you say he screamed?
Allahu Akbar. It's Arabic for...
Yeah, man, that's crazy, but, I mean, you know, white people speak Arabic, too. Like, a blonde white guy could also yell that, you know?
I didn't mention his skin color.
Look, I'm just saying, there's really... There's no information or motive here or anything. We're just gonna drive ourselves crazy trying to figure it out. So, you know, a big part of mystery solving is just knowing when to quit.
Why not interview people from his community?
What community? It could have literally been anyone, you know? It could have been a Norwegian social worker who was on vacation here, you know? Like, we just don't know.
You know what? Maybe we're just gonna search her for DNA.
Why, do you think some people are genetically prone to this kind of thing?
No, it could help us solve the crime?
I mean, maybe it's not a crime. Maybe it could just be someone's culture, you know?
Shh, quiet! Someone four blocks away is typing hate speech about this on their keyboard! Got him! Looks like we found the real criminal after all!
You're under arrest.
People learn through story, and entertainment media is the most powerful way of shaping people's values that's ever existed. And it's totally dominated by the left. And they've been using it for decades to chip away at your country with their propaganda. That's why we're fighting back by making a full-length animated show called Twisted Plots. It delivers a right-wing message through jokes and story. We've got a week left, and it's time for our final push. To help get us fully funded and watch our full-length pilot episode, go to twistedplots.com. We've got the track record, the team, and the experience. Give us your support, and we'll be unstoppable.
All right, that's the great Freedom Tunes on X at freedom_tunes. twistedplots.com. You can go there to contribute to their fundraising for their new show, which I think is a very valuable weapon system in the information war, using humor to expose the reality of what's going on. And again, it's not easy to make something like this funny, because it's not funny, because it's horrifying, brutal. And again, myself and frankly the whole crew were too engrossed in this story. We totally didn't even realize we'd gone to commercial break, so I'm not even sure where this got cut off. But again, just imagine being the mother of a 21-year-old son who, despite all the headwinds against you, despite all of the difficulties that the average white UK British person faces, from the relentless demonization of them to the fact that, you know, 27 foreigners get jobs before a single British person. Imagine being a mother who, through all of the chaos and headwinds, raise your son to where he is a productive, employed 21-year-old, and knowing that he may be about to be sent to prison for the next 5 years of his life because he threw a traffic cone in the general direction of police. He didn't hurt anybody. He didn't threaten to hurt anybody. He merely expressed outrage at the fact that the local police had handcuffed a dying 18-year-old, and they're now sending him to jail for 3 to 5 years for pleading guilty, for not fighting it, saying, look, I did it. I was there. I got caught up in the moment. I threw a cone. It didn't hurt anybody, but yeah, I was angry. I threw a cone. I threw a traffic cone in the direction of police. I did do that. And they go, okay, well, 5 years then, 5 years in prison, 5 years. You know, I don't know if there's a chance at this point, but like, this is the type of thing that, like, I don't think you are morally obligated to apply to comply with that. I actually think you have a moral right to resist this with everything you've got, because this isn't fair. This isn't justice. This isn't the appropriate activity of a legitimate government proceeding. This is a racialized gulag system. A 21-year-old who's never been in trouble with the cops, never even hinted at, you know, criminal activity, who's gainfully employed, and who throws a traffic cone, doesn't hurt anybody, maybe going to jail for 5 years. When people who locked little girls in dog cages get 2 years. I think you have a moral right to, like, resist with violence and just go, I'm not going to prison. You have no right to throw me to prison for this. Cries his eyes out in court. Yeah, I bet he did. A protester who threw a traffic cone at police during demonstrations in Southampton following the murder of Henry Novak has refused to enter the court because he was crying his eyes out. Now, this is a different kid. Connor Bishop, 24, was hauled into Southampton's magistrate court after he was caught on video hurling the objects at retreating police officers. However, he then refused to leave his cell and enter the courtroom because he was sobbing and was left to his lawyer to enter his guilty plea to violent disorder on his behalf. Elsewhere, two other men appeared at Portsmouth magistrate court. Noah Etherington, 18, pled guilty to violent disorder by throwing a brick towards police officers, while Reese Robinson, 21, admitted the same offense after he threw objects at police. All three men are accused of taking part in violent demonstrations that rocked Southampton on Tuesday evening after Vikram Digwa, 23, was jailed on Monday. Describing Bishop's offense, prosecutor Kevin Lucy told Southampton Magistrates Court, Mr. Bishop attended the planned protest at 6 p.m. on June 2nd. At first, he didn't seem to be getting involved, but effectively he has seen later clips where he does become involved. So yeah, 24-year-old, an 18-year-old, and a 21-year-old are going to have their lives destroyed for daring to be outraged at the police for basically killing an 18-year-old kid. Like, this is what I said. Like, I don't know, man. Y'all are not taking this seriously enough. You really aren't. And this is one of those kids, you know, sometimes I feel like a hypocrite, right? When it's like, you see things happening in places like Ireland, and I'm like, the Irish need to stand up against this. But, like, this doesn't happen to us. This doesn't happen here. It wouldn't happen here. And if they tried, I don't know how it would go. But that's crazy. But that's what I said. It's like, listen, if you're in the UK, if you're going to go to any protest as a white guy, as a young white guy, if you're going to a protest, wear a mask. This is what I mean when I talk. It's like white people haven't accepted that we're not in charge anymore. Because we're not, for all intents and purposes. Like, people have this idea that it's like, it's our country, you know, we're just going to go and make demands, and it's our country after all, and we're the ones who have to live with this, and we're the ones who get to say how things are here. And so they go and just act like they're the ones in charge still. You're not. You are a hated minority now. You are a underground resistance. You just aren't acting like it, which is why it's not working. I literally said that. You know, during these riots, going, look, either if you're going to turn a protest into a riot, that riot has to, like, have goals and has to, like, do something. Like, you have to, like, take over a building and be like, we're not leaving until you guarantee we will not be prosecuted. Like, that's what it's going to take. Or you need to be masked and you need to take steps to conceal your identity, because It doesn't matter if you get away that day. They're going to use facial recognition. They're going to use biometrics. They're going to find out who you are, and they're going to throw you in prison for years, even if you didn't do anything wrong. You've got to accept that. You've got to understand that now. Like I said, you, every white guy in the UK right now, if you are not a total globalist cuck selling out your country or a police officer in the force, but I repeat myself, then you are in the, you are a member of a like active military resistance network. You just aren't acting like it. You're acting as if you're still in charge. This is, it is genuinely crazy. It's like if the French resistance was just going out and holding protest against Nazis. You think that would work? You think the Nazis would put up with that? You are the resistance now. You are the underground. You are European Hezbollah. Whether you act like it or not, that's how you're going to be treated. So you might as well start acting like Hezbollah, right? Like, you might as well start acting like the French resistance, because that's how they see you. I swear to God, it's like they don't realize that. Did you not see what happened at the Southport riots last year? It was the exact same thing. It was the exact same thing. So I'm not blaming these. You know, obviously, this is horrifying. They took his guilty plea and then informed him by video that, with it being such a high-profile case, that his guilty plea, the sentencing guideline, were between 3 and 5 years for a guilty plea. With that, he said he's remanding him in custody and he will be sentenced Monday morning at Southampton Crown Court at 1000 in front of, at 10, I guess, in front of him personally. Now take him away. If that's not two-tier justice, I don't know what is. And that's a young 21-year-old white boy, full-time job, never been in trouble, and dealt with that swiftly. He throws a cone at nobody. 2 days later, he's in jail, awaiting whether to find out he'll be 24 or 26 when he gets out. 5 years of a young man's life stolen because he decided to be a little bit outraged at what the police... Meanwhile, the police absolutely brutalized people who had done absolutely nothing. This is from Reform Party Group. Just sat in Portsmouth Magistrate Court and watched my son plead guilty for throwing a traffic cone, which was caught on camera. So this is the one that we just read. I'm still in shock. I don't know. I mean, you shouldn't be. You shouldn't be in shock. You should know this by now, to be honest with you. They really do. I mean, it really is like, well, you know, my son was a member of the French Resistance, and he was out there protesting against the Nazis, and the Nazi court is throwing him in jail. I'm shocked. They're sending him to a concentration camp. What? It's like, yeah, he's a member of the French Resistance under Nazi-occupied France. What do you think is going to happen when he gets caught? What do you think is going to happen if you give them any excuse to punish you? It's a high-profile case, of course. You know what that means. We like to refer to this as the doctrine of severity. The point is the absurdity. The point of doing this is to teach everybody we're crazy. We don't abide by logic. We don't abide by consistency. It doesn't matter if you didn't do anything or not. If you even are close to have been doing something, then we will destroy your life. It doesn't matter if you're a great person. It doesn't matter if you have a legitimate grievance. It doesn't matter if you didn't hurt anybody. If you oppose us, we will destroy you. That is the lesson being sent here. That is the message being sent. It is a doctrine of severity. And they're happy to destroy the lives of productive young men in pursuit of this. Meanwhile, we can go to clip number 13 here. This is a 50-year-old father of three. A man who is a veteran, served his country, and was simply standing off to the side watching events unfold in Southampton when he was set upon by a bunch of hyper-violent thugs from the hive of wokery that purports to be a police force. Vile and disgusting. It's clear, Hampshire, that you have no that you have a culture of callous cruelty. These disgusting thugs should be in cells right now next to their cruel, heartless colleagues who handcuffed Henry and watched him die. You have no right to call yourself the police. You are despicable tyrants. So clip number 30 here, where this 50-year-old man who, and actually gets worse, but I'll tell you about who this guy really is in a second. But this is the way the police treated you know, random UK citizens who didn't throw cones. They didn't throw rocks. He was literally just standing there when the police did this to him. Let's watch. They grab this guy, bash him with the shield, bash him more with the shield. 5-6 guys here piling on top of him. Then they start kneeing him in the head. They're pinning him down and just kneeing him over and over. That was 3 massive knee hits. Now, this is the other video, right? So this is the full video. This should be clip number 16. Oh no, yeah, this is them beating him and people commenting. But that angle that we just saw, that second angle with the guy saying they're beating that geezer and they're about to kill him. It actually shows the full event. Because people on the left were suggesting that this was out of context and the guy had thrown a brick and so the police were arresting him correctly. But here it is. So he's right there. You can see him in the red hat, in the black hat, and he's sitting, start moving forward. That's it. And that's where the police start hitting him. He just remains sitting on the brick wall there, and there they start attacking him. So you can see in the video, he'd been sitting there for about 30 minutes. He had not moved. He was not a part of the crowd that was antagonizing the police. He was sitting off to the side on a brick wall. By the way, the man is injured. I suppose I assume he was injured, you know, during his military service, but he's a veteran and he has 3 pins in his ankles. And he basically told him afterwards, he was like, I can't move that fast. I was sitting on this brick wall. You suddenly demand we move. And then before I know it, I'm being hit in the face with a shield and dragged to the ground. That's the way the police treated the protesters. But if you dare to throw a traffic cone in their general direction, you go to jail for 5 years. You can be doing absolutely nothing. They can slam you in the face with a shield, tackle you to the ground, knee you in the back of the head 4 or 5 times. Because how dare you not move the instant that they say they want you to, even if you are, you know, crippled and have a physical ailment. But like this is the condition of the British police. They don't go after the Muslim guys on horseback. That's scary. No, they go after the crippled veteran who wasn't doing anything wrong. And it takes 6 of them to bring him down. Should we play the grasshopper scene from Bug's Life right now? Because that's what we're dealing with. Only, at least in the Bug's Life, the grasshoppers were impressive. At least in the Bug's Life, the grasshoppers were physically imposing and capable of extreme violence. The British police are just pathetic cucks. Only capable of wielding violence against old crippled men. Terrified of even, you know, negatively addressing Muslim people. Meanwhile, so scared of a 21-year-old throwing a traffic cone that they want to send him to jail for 5 years. I think you guys should rise up. I think actually the solution to this is violent revolution. I'm pretty sure. I don't know. I'll have to check my sources. But I'm pretty sure the more I look at the UK, the more I realize we should be running guns to them. We should literally be dropping paratroopers onto the UK to forcibly overthrow the UK. They need regime change is what they need. They need America to deliver democracy to them. They need ethnic cleansing of the foreigners in their country. That's actually what they need. Until you understand that to a sufficient degree, it's going to be Groundhog's Day. Now, I pulled in 2 different videos, guys. You can let me know when we have that, because obviously America is also not immune from the things that are happening. Yeah, disabled veteran, father of 3, Matt Styler, charged with attacking Southampton police, remanded in custody after pleading not guilty. Prosecutor Nola Bond, in essence, it is part of the riots following the murder of Henry Nowak. The defendant was seen sitting on a wall. So they charged him. They charged him with attacking police when they literally attacked him. And again, they don't, you know, I mean, just imagine. Just really imagine what it'd be like. Like, just imagine what you've done over the last 5 years. Imagine every Thanksgiving, every Christmas, every holiday, every birthday, every conversation you've had with a member of your family over the last 5 years. Just imagine all of that being stolen from you. Imagine being a little kid whose dad stolen from them for 5 years. because they were sitting on a wall when police decided they deserved a shield in the face. Now, meanwhile, while white people are literally imprisoned for nothing in the UK, let's go to clip number three here. This is on patrol with London's Shamrim. This is the capital's Jewish Community Protection Volunteer Group. So this is the armed Jewish militia that portrays themselves as police, but aren't actually police. Sky News went on a ride-along with Shamrim as they responded to calls on the street, stepping in to defuse confrontations. I bet you didn't realize how out of control and rampant anti-Semitism is. They spend 1 hour with Shamrim, and apparently there's all these confrontations happening. They're apparently very busy. Let's watch. Vile anti-Semitism on patrol with Jewish volunteers.
With anti-Semitism surging, we're scrambling to a call for help.
A lady, she's been locked in and victim of anti-Semitic abuse, and she's extremely anxious.
These men are not police officers, but Northwest London volunteers with the Jewish community support group, Shomrim, the Hebrew word for guards. We arrive to find two versions of events. The husband of the Jewish woman has dashed to the scene, afraid for the safety of his wife and young child. He wouldn't speak on camera, scared of what he called an anti-Semitic mob, but told us his wife was taunted about a recent arson attack on Jewish ambulances. Two men and a woman say they weren't blocking her in, but had broken down. They denied making anti-Semitic comments, but seemed annoyed by one of the Jewish men who allegedly referred to Shomrim as our police, though this is disputed.
All right, hold on. Let's pause it. All right, the first act of anti-Semitism. What? And so someone calls and is like, there's an anti-Semitic mob. My wife is in danger. They were making comments about an arson. This is so crazy. The anti-Semitic arson that they're talking about didn't even exist. Oh my God. It's like layers of this. So there was the stabbing on Golders Green of the crazy Muslim guy who stabbed a Muslim person and two Jewish people. Then following that, there were like two or three examples of fires occurring near temples, near synagogues. And so these were reported as anti-Semitic arson attacks against synagogues. They weren't arson, they weren't attacks, and they weren't synagogues being burned. So here, I guess a Jewish guy calls the Jewish guards because he says somebody is making a comment about the arson attacks that didn't actually exist. And when they get there, the people are like, what are you talking about? Our car broke down. And the Jewish people there are saying they're blocking us in with their car. They're threatening us. Please come quick, Jewish guards. And the Jewish guards show up and the people are like, what? Our car broke down. We didn't say anything to these people. Okay, let's go back to the horrifying, harrowing, you know, anti-Semitism patrol from the UK. Let's watch.
Ultimately is diffused and the Jewish woman manages to drive off.
Oh, thank goodness.
The reason why she called was because
she survived.
They said, you Jews think that you could do whatever you want.
True.
And that's why your ambulances were burnt down. And I just want to see if the car's still stuck.
So we're just going back actually to see whether the broken down car has now moved or not. It's about 6 minutes since we pulled away. Let's see.
Magic. The car's gone to the side. Now, who's saying the truth? That may be quite telling.
Wait, so the car was still there?
What you're saying is because the car is gone 6 minutes later.
He didn't say it was gone. He said it was been pulled to the side.
Was being deliberately parked there to block that woman in and intimidate her.
100%. And with vile anti-Semitic comments.
Volunteer Ben Grosnas is a luxury furniture salesman. Avi Ball works in online sales, but was one of the first on the scene at a double stabbing a few months ago. As we drive round Golders Green, it's clear how nervous people are. Just a few hours before we went on patrol with Shomrim, a major fire saw them inundated with calls.
Literally just people worried, obviously speculating if it is or isn't.
My God, it's literally just responding to their paranoid fears about nothing. We're going to continue this on the other side. These are the Jewish patrols that are given license by the British government. All right, welcome back, folks. Shamrim. Shamrim means guard, and it's basically a private Jewish police force that operates globally. We're watching as Sky News is on patrol with them. If we can bring up Caitlin Johnson's tweet, I thought she hit the nail on the head here. I don't want to read it. She says, Sky News ran a segment about how a Jewish volunteer group is on the streets fighting record levels of anti-Semitism, and zero anti-Semitism occurs anywhere in the entire segment. It's just a group of thugs cruising around intimidating non-Jews by impersonating law enforcement. Bing. Yep, she nailed it. She nailed it. Bingo. That's exactly what this is. So let's go back to the, Jewish cosplayers driving around responding to basically paranoid outrages by the Jewish community, who are not under any threat, but apparently are constantly calling Shamrim to come help them. Crazy. Let's watch.
So afterwards, the preliminary is that it's an electrical fault.
Electrical fault.
Distress. They've just been...
So, okay, let's pause it. Let's pause it. What he just said there... There was a fire, I guess, in their community, and they said the number of calls to Shamrim exploded. They came full. So literally, there's an electric fire, and he just admitted. He's like, well, yeah, it turned out to be just like an electrical thing. Remember what I just said? It wasn't arson, wasn't a synagogue, wasn't an attack. It's the exact same thing. That's what they're talking about. They're like, they're on heightened alert ever since the anti-Semitic arson attack on the synagogue, by which, of course, we mean the electrical fire on the place near the synagogue. And so they're being flooded with calls of people going, we're under attack. They're burning our synagogue down. And it's literally just like, you mean the house down the road that had the electrical fire? We're on it, ma'am. Back to the paranoid freaks.
Tempers are flaring at the side of the road.
There's nothing wrong in public reporting.
A Jewish man has been accused of taking pictures of a Muslim cleric, which he denies.
Do you think that some people who aren't Jewish feel a little bit intimidated by the Shamrim?
Absolutely not. We, across board, are called by anyone. You don't have to be Jewish to call us.
Perhaps some members of the Muslim community might feel a bit awkward when you show up. I mean, how do you think that might...
Well, we just spoke to that imam over there, and he was very happy to speak to us and very happy that we defused the situation.
All this in just over an hour in one part of London. Volunteers doing their bit to try to keep a lid on simmering community tensions and record levels of anti-Semitism.
All of that in just an hour. I mean, my God, it's overwhelming. Clearly, they need tens of millions of dollars of British taxpayer money. Thank goodness they're getting it from Keir Starmer, right? I mean, Jewish guys were stabbed. Muslim guys were stabbed too. But hey, the synagogue got caught on fire, okay? We're just going to go. We're just going to run with that. We're going to use that as a basis for deciding other things, even though it is untrue in the first place. But hey, it was an anti-Semitic attack. And obviously, when there's an attack against an identity like that, the only thing the British government can do is give their private police force tens of millions of dollars, allow them to carry weapons, promise to use every power capable of the government to benefit the beautiful Jewish people. Of course, when it's a white person that it happens to, you will go to jail. You will go to jail for saying something should happen. The Jewish community gets stabbed. They get tens of millions of dollars. They get, you know, to run a fake police force. But when a white person dies, you will go to jail for saying anything like that should happen for you. Okay, how dare you? And yeah, it is an international force. Brooklyn Safety Patrol. No, they call themselves the Safety Patrol in Brooklyn. Brooklyn Jewish thugs sentenced to 17 years for abusing girl. Jacob Daskal, head of Private Orthodox Crime Patrol, called Shamrim, by the way, they don't mention it in the headline because they want it to continue. Took a 15-year-old runaway to his upstate home. Her family thought he was helping. Well, what do you know? What a shocking development, I say. After a 15-year-old girl had run away from her Brooklyn home in 2017, her relatives turned to help to a trusted figure, Jacob Daskal, head of a private crime patrol called the Borough Park Shamrim Society. The girl's aunt and uncle asked Mr. Daskal to help find her niece a place to live, and he offered his summer home in upstate New York. Something's messed up in our system. Usually the song kicks in towards the end of a segment, so if I'm not looking at the clock, I know it's coming. But the last two times it hasn't gone off, so I end up, I'm covering a story, and I look up and I realize we're a minute into a break. So I don't even know where I got cut off there. I'm sorry. We're too into the stories. We're paying too much attention to what's going on because it's all so unbelievably insane. So yeah, I don't know if y'all did the, I don't know. Did y'all hear about that last story? Shamrim leader in Brooklyn kidnaps a girl and, takes her to upstate New York and threatens to handcuff her and tells her, I'm a really big guy. I'm protected by the police. And if you try to expose me, it'll only go badly for you. It sounds like he's a member of a mob of some sort. It sounds like he's a member of some sort of Jewish mafia that has connections with the police force that run these private militias that they apparently use to kidnap and rape little girls. That's crazy, right? How crazy is that? Sir, they just upped it to DEFCON 3. Watch out, Kanye. Shamrim's coming to get you. The community guards, the beautiful, lovely, despicable scumbag guards. American YouTuber Tyler Oliveira was harassed by Shamrim police in New Jersey. The Shamrim are a Jewish police force funded by the taxpayer. We are being policed by a secondary form of law enforcement. This is insane. Well, the insane thing about it is that he didn't do anything wrong. See, the police are actually police, and they don't respond to non-crimes. The Shamrim aren't actually police, and they respond to whatever they want to. See how that works? They're under no obligation to actually, you know, stop crime. I don't know if they have the ability to stop crime anyway. They are just, you know, Jewish intimidation. They are a Jewish militia that's there to make sure, you know, I guess you don't expose them. Like Tyler Oliveira going to New Jersey and trying to film fraud going on is not illegal. The police wouldn't show up for that. Shamrim does, though. And they present themselves as police. They present themselves as law enforcement, and they are apparently taxpayer funded. There's more. As anti-Semitism rises in the UK, Shamrim volunteers help protect Jewish communities. Brooklyn private Jewish patrols wield power. Some call them bullies. Well, some anti-Semites, maybe. Some vicious anti-Semites. That'll be illegal soon. Don't worry about that. I don't know why anybody puts up with it. Like, so just think about it. In the UK, the Jews have Shamrim. The Sikhs are allowed to carry giant knives around. The Muslims basically act as if they are above the law and are routinely caught with mosques literally jammed full of weaponry. But they're never punished for it, never held to account for it. You are literally arming and giving license to act freely to everybody except for white people. White people, on the other hand, are being thrown into prison for 5 years for throwing a traffic cone into the air. So, armed revolution. I think armed revolution is the only answer here. I'm looking through history and, yep, turns out the only way this gets fixed is by overthrowing your government. The good news is you still operate under this sort of archaic system called monarchy, which is kind of like a game that you can win. You know, Game of Thrones, because whoever gets the throne gets to lead. Shamrim leader pleads guilty to bribing cops for gun permits. I mean, I'm shocked. Oh, my God. You're telling me that the volunteer Jewish police force is consistently and routinely caught in illegal activity? What? What are you talking about? Are you telling me that these Jewish police officers, these fake Jewish police officers, are you telling me they're anything but the most upstanding and moral people, that they're motivated by something other than genuine concern for safety and peace of all people? How dare you? How dare you suggest that all the evidence we've presented makes that conclusion abundantly clear? How dare you? Okay. There's one thing I know. It's that arming Jewish people and giving them license to act over and above everybody else, that always turns out well. That always goes really well, and there's never been a negative consequence to that type of activity. So keep it up. It's good. I'm in favor of it. Okay. I want to see more Shamrim. I want to replace our regular police with Shamrim. Let's replace ICE with Shamrim. Let's just give over our military to Israel. Let's give over our police force to Israel. I think they should be allowed to patrol as they see fit. And I think we should only have one law. I think you shouldn't be allowed to be anti-Semitic. I think everything else is kind of fine. Okay? Murder, who cares, right? Rape, it happens to everyone. Get over it. Okay? Anti-Semitism, opposing the actions of the police, that's the only crime. Okay? Should be the only crime. It's the only bad. It's the only sin, actually. Ten Commandments is passé. All that's passé. Pornography is great and good and amazing and wonderful. Homosexuality should be embraced by every little child. Transgenderism, all that stuff. It's not sinful. It's good and wonderful. The only sin that exists is to oppose Jewish people, okay? It's the only sin. It should be the only law, as far as I'm concerned. Good is submission to Jews. Bad is opposing Jews. That is the moral delineation that our country was founded on, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure I read that in the Declaration of Independence somewhere. So I'm in favor of it. You're not allowed to call me an anti-Semite. I want this to be the case. And I'm happy it's happening. To close out our coverage of race, the DOJ has announced that the SPLC paid Klan members a monthly salary to stay in the KKK and recruit new members. What a nonprofit would do this is sick and just sad. What were they thinking? I think I can actually explain. See, the Southern Poverty Law Center paid Klan members to stay in the KKK, according to the Department of Justice. The Southern Poverty Law Center allegedly used about $4.1 million in donor funds to pay the Ku Klux Klan members to remain in the group, reimbursing them for expenses such as cross-burning materials and two Klan garments. Why ever would the SPLC support the Klan of all people? Maybe because the Klan is a defunct and purposeless movement that has been thoroughly discredited in the eyes of all Americans and only serves to drive people away from the cause of white solidarity or white representation. Maybe that's why. Either they actually like the KKK, or this is a pretty obvious, sophisticated, controlled opposition operation. Which is funny because you'll see newspaper articles about the SPLC funding white groups. And the New York Post, for example, I believe it was the New York Post, used a picture of Patriot Front in the article about the SPLC funding white groups. They don't fund Patriot Front. They don't fund Patriot Front. Why? Because Patriot Front is effective, are nonviolent, are actually successful and capable of making their case in a convincing way. They're extremely disciplined and don't allow their members to commit violence or, you know, even respond when violence is committed against them. They're not supporting them, are they? Who are they supporting? They're supporting the cross-burning KKK. Because the KKK is bad for white people. Things like Patriot Front, I would argue, are good. So they're not funding this like they're actually funding the KKK. They're attempting to divert any, you know, concern about the status and condition of white people in this country towards the most ineffective and reviled organizations, and then trying to tie those organizations to the new organizations that have cropped up who have, you know, legitimate grievances and effective strategies for dealing with them. There's a reason that they funded the KKK, and it's because it's the KKK. And they want that to be the face of white people. It's not that complicated. The KKK is just like the least popular thing ever, right? In America, it's just never, there's not going to be a resurgence, okay? There's not going to be a renaissance of KKK. It's just not going to happen. So they want to keep that going. So if white people are, you know, actually looking around and going, gee, it seems like my race is under attack. It seems like my people will die out if something's not done. Maybe I should get involved. What they want you to do is go towards the KKK people, who's a bunch of old boomers who do absolutely nothing but make all white people look bad. That's great. They want you going there. They don't want you being a groiper. They don't want you to follow Alex Jones Network. They don't want you supporting people and organizations that can effectively argue against this stuff, can effectively even mobilize against this stuff. They want you taken into ineffective, pointless, and hateful groups, quite frankly. So it sounds like the KKK just is the SPLC. Robert Malone says, not a single story written by progressive mainstream media on this, Ground News, an aggregate service of both left and right news, only can find numerous articles from the media on the right to source. No left-wing mainstream media news site could be bothered to write a story on this development. I wonder why, insert sarcasm. I respect Robert Malone. I get where he's coming from. He says, so what do the New York Times write about this case that the SPLC is accused has accused the DOJ of vindictive prosecution, not a peep about the Klan members being paid. You can't make this stuff up. The headline from New York Times, Southern Poverty Law Center accuses Justice Department of vindictive prosecution. The reason no progressives are writing about this is because they think it's a appropriate and good use of money. And the thing is, I think the SPLC may be able to make that case in court. They may be able to make the case because basically what they're charged with is fraud. And the idea is that people gave to the SPLC thinking they were fighting against racism, and then they turned around and gave the money to the most racist groups in the world. Would seem like a cut and dry case, except that it's an obvious strategy and probably a successful one to keep the, unpopular, stupid, ineffective programs going. I bet they can make that case. And I bet they can make the case that their donors approve of what their money was used for. So how could it be fraud? I don't know if this prosecution is going to work. I think the SPLC is going to be able to lay out, look, here was our plan. Here's why we did this. We think that, we want any white person. It's like how the FBI runs Muslim sting operations, right? It's the same thing the FBI does. The FBI pays people to go in and join radical Muslim groups because they're informants. I think the SPLC is going to be able to make that case and say, look, we're just doing what police officers do and FBI agents do. We're utilizing an effective, counter-racist strategy here. So I don't know if the SPLC is even going to succeed in any of this, but just know if the SPLC is funding you, it's because you're working for them. Okay? They aren't trying to create racism so that they have something to combat. They're hijacking legitimate concerns about white people being discriminated against and replaced in our homeland, and they want to morph that into the literal Klan, into cross-burning, noose-hanging type of activity. What they definitely don't want, what they are not funding, what they're doing everything in their can to stop happening, is white people getting together to be politically active in a peaceful and structured way. Who the SPLC never donates to are people like myself or Nick Fuentes or Patriot Front or any of these other groups that are, being accused of being feds by people. You clearly are missing the central thing that makes organizations like the KKK so objectionable. It is the unoptical and violent and aggressive strategy that they pursue. Those are the people that the SPLC funds. Really not that complicated. It's really not. We have some more information about the Kushners and Ivanka Trump and their purchase of the Albanian land. And the protest against against the purchase by the Zionist elite of large portions of the Albanian coast are absolutely going out of control, and they're really, really putting us to shame, us Americans. This should be what we should be doing, because our country is being stolen to a much, much greater degree than Albania's is. Albania, thousands protest against Ivanka Trump / Jared Kushner purchasing massive private island equipped with 3,500 nuclear bunkers and miles of tunnels. Thousands of Albanians clashed with police this week during protest against an island tourist resort planned by a company linked to President Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and daughter Ivanka Trump. The $1.4 billion island of Sazan was formerly a communist-era military base with 3,500 nuclear bunkers, unexploded weapons, bomb shelters, and miles of tunnels, according to The Independent. Ivanka recently described how she and her husband came across the 1,400-acre ex-military base saying they were on a friend's boat when they stopped for a swim and swam to the island. We went on a hike, barefoot, all the way to the top, and we were just captivated, she explained. Glenn Greenwald commented, saying the most darkly funny aspect of this video is Ivanka Trump speaks as if she went on some profound, prolonged, spiritual, philosophical journey to ascertain the meaning of life and concluded the most elevated human state is to live on a gigantic private island in the Mediterranean in a sprawling mansion paid for with the billions of dollars given to her husband by the Saudis and Emiratis to ensure favorable treatment by him and her dad in the exercise of power of the American presidency. Real uplifting stuff here. Real uplifting stuff. But it could be significantly more sinister than that. After all, we know that Alexander Soros considers the president of Albania one of his best friends. We can go to the videos of some of the protests going on in Albania. Fourth night of protests in Albania against mega tourism project in a natural reserve linked to Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. Protesters demand suspension and defend Albanians' land. And again, like you got to be this way. You have to be this hardcore. They cannot get a foot in the door. Right? Because that's the way this always works. It's always like, wow, you're really freaking out about this little land deal. I mean, what's the big problem? All these other people have land deals. I notice you're not mad about that. You know, maybe you're anti-Semitic, you know? And that's always the argument, right? Oh, you care so much about Israel. I never see you talk about Qatar. Maybe it's because you have bad motivations. You're protesting Jared Kushner, but you didn't protest the other one that was elsewhere that didn't matter as much. So maybe you're an anti-Semite. Maybe that's the thing that's motivating you. And no joke, the president of Albania, the guy who's best friends with Alexander Soros and best friends with Jared Kushner, best friends with the transnational Jewish control grid, he just came out and said that the riots in Albania are being funded by Iran. They're being funded by Iran, which is kind of interesting. It's kind of an interesting tactic to take, isn't it? Why would Iran be funding protests in Albania? I think they've got other things to be concerned about. Is it possibly because selling land in Albania to the Kushners is actually a part of a Zionist plot? Is that why? Could this be because it's being bankrolled by Israel and that Iran is trying to stop it? Because I don't think Iran's actually involved. I think this is a legitimate protest from the Albanian people against part of their country being sold to a couple Israeli psychopath genociders. I don't think they need, you know, extra funding and resources and encouragement to protest that. I think it's a valuable and an appropriate response in the first place. Here they are burning the president's home. So again, it's not that there's evidence of Iran doing this. The president is saying that because he wants Israel's help in putting down his own people. And he's saying it because he knows that this is a part of a Zionist plot. And so he's blaming the Iranians for opposition. But really, that's just an unintended admission by the president. That's how I interpret it. I do not believe that Iran is funding these protests. I don't think that Albania is exactly on the top of their list. And I don't think the Albanians need extra encouragement to protest takeover of their country. But I do think that blaming the Iranians by the Albanian president, the best friend of Alexander Soros, is very telling as to what he believes is motivating these people, which again, you know, it's, I'm trying to think of a metaphor of just like when you say something that just didn't, it's basically like, it's like, oh, you know, all these people are protesting you selling this pristine wetlands to foreigners. And they're like, oh, well, maybe they're anti-Semites. And it's like, we didn't say anything. Wait, is this a Jewish thing? You know, it's kind of like, well, wait, is that what? Oh, well, you just must hate Israel and want to see them fail. And you must be an anti-Semite. It's like, well, we didn't mention Israel. We didn't mention Zion. We didn't mention anything like that. But the fact that you immediately go there tells me that that's where you're coming from. That actually is what's behind this. It's pretty interesting. Interesting inadvertent admission. Albanians did it. Israeli settlers are facing displacement. So basically, they broke into the construction site where all this is going on, and they, you know, attacked the places where, yeah, this is the crowd. Wow, those Iranians are real good at putting a crowd out, huh? Gee, if they're capable of doing this in Albania, you'd think they'd do it elsewhere at some point. Nah, they only did this in Albania, and only to stop Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump from building a private island paradise. Crazy how that happens, huh? if they can get a crowd of a million people out on Albanian streets, but haven't bothered to do it anywhere else. Huh. Wonder why they would choose Albania. If we can go to this video. Albanian, and obviously this has been translated, so it's not exact, but he says, Albanian did it. Albanians did it. Israeli settlers facing displacement. Time for us to free Seaport, Camps Bay, Stellenbosch. Israeli settlers must leave. They must go back to Ukraine. And so there's these, you know, temporary shelters for the construction workers. And basically Albania is like, no, we know what this is. These are Israeli settlements. No, we know what's happening in the West Bank. We know how it starts. You know, oh, we're just going to set up some temporary shelters. We're actually, it's going to bring you, you know, economic benefit. What, you don't want Albania to benefit economically? You don't want them to have a new $1 billion, you know, private island paradise? This is for you. It's going to benefit you. Of course. So I guess this was in South Africa. Are they doing it in South Africa too? Yeah, Israel's colonizing the world. I mean, y'all are seeing this, right? Argentina, Greece, Albania, apparently South Africa, Thailand. They've already got a place in Russia, an oblast all to themselves. Obviously, Ukraine is being cleansed out, except for the Jews that live there. Yeah, I think they're building colonies. I think that's just what this is. Now, interestingly, the area that this is being built looks like they're trying to set up a situation in which Israel owns basically every strait, every, you know, passageway through the oceans. Because if we go to Dotcam here, Kushner, Trump's Zionist son-in-law, buys a coast in Albania. Then on the opposite coast, Israelis are buying land in Puglia. Some say it will become a strait all in the hands of the Israelis. Conspiracy theorists say that. Albanians are at least protesting. Italy is not. So apparently Israel is buying land here and the Kushners are buying land here. Nothing suspicious about that. They definitely aren't trying to take over a strait. Certainly has nothing to do with that. How dare you? What are you, anti-Semitic? They just loved the land.
Gal syndrome from a tick on my ankle. Chemtrail overhead while the skyline tangles. Glyphosate dinners in the microwave tray. Talking to the checkout robot every damn day. Microplastics drift through the blood in my veins. Politicians smile while they chemically rain. Barcode babies in a cashless state. Everybody says relax while they seal in our fate. Television doctors push another new pill. 5 side effects deep, but they say just chill. Corn syrup cocktails and fluorescent and cheese, drones in the clouds while they map the trees. Wi-Fi towers hum through the side of my skull. World keeps spinning, but the vibe feels dull. Synthetic meat sizzling black on the grate. End times buffet at the digital gate. New world order on the television screen. Smoke in the sky where the satellites gleam. Everybody march to the barcode gate. Whole world glitching in a digital state.
Absolutely brilliant. I think that's the best work he's ever done. That was Wars of the Info on X. I thought that was fantastic. Honestly, I think I like that more than anything else he's ever done. Wars of the Info on X. Follow him now. He does come out with a lot of good stuff. It's hard to say. It's hard to say what the best is, but yeah, he got it. He got it right. So we're talking about Albania. And the Kushner's very suspicious purchase there. And, you know, it reminds me a lot of the ballroom. You know, this ballroom that Donald Trump is building, where it's just like, oh, it's going to be a beautiful ballroom. It's so nice. And we need a ballroom. We need a ballroom to do big events, don't we? Don't you want a big ballroom to do events in? And then it's like, oh, by the way, we need billions of dollars because we're building a sophisticated bunker underneath. That's actually going to be a command and control center for the new AI digital panopticon. So what do you mean you don't want a ballroom? You don't want a place for people to dance? We're just going to dance there. What's wrong with you, right? It's very much the same vibe. Like, what? It's a beautiful island. We're going to have a private resort. There's going to be water slides, okay? Sure, we're buying it at a, you know, formerly, you know, Cold War era nuclear bunker site. But that's what was available. I don't know what to tell you. And yeah, it kind of does happen to be right across a thin piece of water from another land that the Israelis are buying. What a coincidence that is. What a crazy coincidence. But don't look into it at all, okay? It's a fun paradise island extravaganza, all right? Stop looking into it already, would you? I'm a little bit suspicious at the Rothschilds and the Kushners going on a little jaunt around the islands and happen to fall in love with this beautiful, magical military island. Isn't it amazing? From alexjoneslive.com, you can go to alexjoneslive.com to find this story. From Kellen McBreen, Albania, thousands protest against Ivanka Trump / Jared Kushner purchasing massive private island equipped with 3,500 nuclear bunkers and miles of tunnels. Kushner revealed in a recent podcast that he privately met with Albania's socialist Prime Minister Edi Rama aboard the Rothschild's boat in 2021, leading him to later discover the island for the project. And that's kind of nice, too, isn't it? Knowing that in 2021, when the rest of us were locked down in our homes watching grandma die through a sheet of plexiglass, that Jared Kushner was having in-person meetings on a yacht in Albania. Isn't that nice? Isn't that fun? It's especially nice and fun because of how he was responsible for the lockdowns in the first place, as this story from brownstone.org notes. The possibility of U.S. lockdowns, never attempted on this scale in the history of pandemics, was already in the air early March 2020. The theory of lockdown had been floating around for 15 years, but now China was the first to try it, and they claimed it was an enormous success, fraudulently. Incredibly, the U.S. was set to try it out, but getting Trump on board was going to take some doing. The federal government had the quarantine power since 1944, that much we knew, but just how expansive could its exercise be? Would they dare quarantine the well along with the sick? How far would this go? Thanks to several journalistic accounts, we have a better idea of what went on in the White House before that dreadful March 16th, 2020 press conference of Donald Trump, Anthony Fauci, and Deborah Birx, in which the lockdowns were announced. Along with that came a flyer with tiny print about which the ever-trusting Trump apparently knew nothing. Bars, restaurants, food courts, gyms, and other indoor and outdoor venues where groups of people congregate should be closed. Read those words again. Has anything like this ever been issued by any government in the history of the world before China did it? I cannot think of a case. It shuts not only the places where people do congregate, but also everywhere they might congregate. Churches, AA meetings, civic clubs, libraries, museums, homes. And all this happened under Trump's watch right here in the U.S. There ought to be a word to describe something more extreme than totalitarian. There were a number of people in Trump's circle in those days who proved panicked and confused enough to embrace the idea, but precisely who wrote those words in the sheet handed out to reporters? We cannot say for sure, but Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner played an important role. He had enlisted two close friends from college to help, Nat Turner and Adam Bowler. Both were graduates from the Wharton School like Trump. Jared somehow believed they knew something about pandemics because they worked in healthcare delivery, so he called them. Bowler headed the $60 billion U.S. International Development Finance Corporation and still does. It's one of those many agencies that throws contracts and cash to big shots within the industry. Before that job, he was head of Landmark Health Delivery Services, which means that he knew business and finance, not public health. He's among those high finance execs that were drawn to healthcare not for the science but for the money. As for Turner, he was a serial entrepreneur who got his start selling snakes from his parents' garage, truly. He founded an ad agency that eventually was sold to Google 10 years ago, Invite Media, for more than $70 million. His company, Flatiron, oncology-related electronic recording software, sold to Roche in 2018 for $1.9 billion. His page on the Wharton School describes him as young, entrepreneurial, and Google-owned. He's now a billionaire investor at an implausibly young age, and he's Google-owned. The book Nightmare Scenario 2021 explains what happened next. On March 13th, 2020, Bowler and Turner burrowed into a room in the basement of the West Wing and started calling people who grasped both the scale of the crisis but also the politics. Over the weekend, they were putting together recommendations that then circulated them with Birx and Fauci. The guidelines were refined farther before being presented to Trump in the Oval Office. They wanted to recommend shutting down in-person education at schools, closing indoor dining at restaurants and bars, canceling travel. Birx and Fauci saw the guidelines as a crucial pause that would buy them some time to better understand the pandemic. Shutting down flights was not enough, they said. More would have to be done. Bowler, Kushner, Birx, Fauci, and other aides presented Trump with the recommendation several days later, anxious over what he might say. Kushner had been preparing Trump for the possibility that they were going to need to take more draconian actions. The account is not speculative. Kushner himself explained in his new book, on my way to the White House early the next morning, March 12th, my billionaire investor brother Josh called from New York City. He described the worrisome signs. The city had canceled its annual St. Patrick's Day parade. Thousands of people were self-quarantining, and millions were leaving the city. When I told him that I was asked to jump into the response, he made a suggestion. You should call Adam. Why not call, for example, a public health scientist, somebody with expertise in viruses, a medical doctor? Universities are packed with them. Somebody, anybody with actual knowledge or experience? Nope. It was entirely a crony operation. Privileged fools about to take over the private lives of hundreds of millions of people. By the way, I want to note, how did he put it? Privileged fools. They're privileged fools with no authority in the federal government, who nobody ever voted for, who had no right to make these decisions on behalf of anybody, let alone everybody. They're literally just random dudes that happen to be familiarly associated with Donald Trump. Like, Kushner has been the engine behind so much of what's wrong with Donald Trump. It's actually pathetic that it's that way. This Adam guy, this Nate guy, they're literally just friends of Kushner, who's just the husband of the president's wife. And for some reason, these people got to dictate the shutdown procedure. And by the way, Deborah Birx, in her book and in interviews she's given, she admits that the strategy was, because Trump wasn't, he didn't want to do the lockdown. He didn't think the lockdown was a good idea. So they convinced him it would only be 2 weeks. That's what the 2 weeks to slow the spread thing was. That was, yes, to get Americans to go along with it, just like in my, you know, skit where it's like, it's only 2 weeks. Yeah, it's not going to go on forever. Definitely not. It's definitely not going to go on for all summer. We're definitely not using this as a way to get our foot in the door, and then we'll expand it every week for the next 60 weeks until we've been in lockdown for a year and we're able to use the lockdown in order to justify the mail-in ballots. That definitely isn't our plan the entire time. They say it was the plan. Deborah Birx says we wanted to shut down indefinitely, but Trump would never go for it. So we convinced him that it would only be 2 weeks. We were able to convince him, like, okay, if it's only 2 weeks, I guess we can do it, knowing full well that they would extend the 2 weeks immediately, which is exactly what they did. And then they go and brag about this as if this was a clever strategy for doing it, for, you know, convincing this, you know, stupid, out-of-touch Trump to do what they needed to. That's literally how they present it, as if Trump is this, like, you know, idiot that can't understand and can't be reasoned with. So they have to trick him. They had to lie to him. And actually, it was a righteous lie. It was a beneficial lie because it got locked down, which saved all everybody's lives. It's just lie upon lie upon lie, obviously. So Jared Kushner and his two billionaire buddies from school, who, you know, they must be great entrepreneurs, right? They must be. I mean, what a coincidence, right? What a crazy coincidence that, like, Jared Kushner, the son of, like, highly connected Zionist billionaires, just happens to become a billionaire himself through realty trades. Like, I guess the genius is inherited. And he just happens to be lifelong friends with people who also just so happen to become billionaires by their mid-20s. That's crazy. Isn't that crazy how talented and successful all these guys are? Certainly, it has nothing to do with a, you know, ethnic mafia benefiting their fellow Jews. That's racist. That's anti-Semitic to say that. No, they're all brilliant geniuses. And yes, they care that much about health that not only are they going to force everybody in America to stay on lockdown, they're going to remove themselves entirely. They're not even going to be here. They're going to quarantine so hard, they're going to do it on a yacht in the Mediterranean. So that's how dedicated they were to the sacrifice being made. Is that while you had to watch your grandmother die through a sheet of glass because the lockdown procedures they designed, they were meanwhile meeting in person with presidents of Albania in between the swimming excursions off the coast of Albania on Nathan Rothschild's yacht. So isn't that interesting? So in 2021, when all of us were under lockdown designed and pushed by Kushner himself was making this deal in Albania, along with George Soros' son and the Rothschilds. It's almost like we're identifying the members of this international Jewish mafia, isn't it? Kind of like that. What is Jared Kushner actually building on Sazan Island? This is from TomElliott.substack.com. On the second night of June 2026, several thousand Albanians took to the streets of Tirana, the capital of Albania, blocking traffic and chanting, "Albania is not for sale." Their immediate target was Prime Minister Edi Rama. Their actual target was a $1.4 billion resort development on Sazan Island, a 1,400-hectare strip of land at the mouth of the Vlor Bay, or Vlori Bay, that was, until recently, a top-secret military zone studded with 3,600 nuclear bunkers and half-century-old Soviet submarine base. Oh, well, that's what you want on your private island, a submarine base. Kind of like the submarine base Jeffrey Epstein's island had, right? Remember how Ghislaine Maxwell was a submarine operator? Remember that? They're just adventurous. They're just adventurous folks. What can we say? They just love a good adventure, you know? I don't know. I don't know if you're thinking that having access to a submarine port would mean that you could clandestinely ship people or goods anywhere in the world, if that would ever be utilized for evil. Not by these people, all right? Not by the Kushners, not by the Maxwells, okay? These are the best of the best. These are our most moral and upstanding citizens that we've ever had, okay? And if you don't think so, have fun in the gulag, all right? It's illegal to say that. We'll be soon. The American developer behind the project is a firm called Atlantic Incubation Partners LLC, affiliated with Jared Kushner's private equity vehicle Affinity Partners, Albania's Special Prosecution Office Against Corruption and Organized Crime, known as SPAK, has opened a formal investigation into the land reclassifications that cleared the way. Most of the international coverage is focused on the optics, Ivanka Trump describing Sazan as a private island the family had discovered, the Aman Resorts branding, the flamingos and Mediterranean monk seals in the adjacent Narta wetlands, the Trump Island jokes on The Daily Show. The optics are bad, but they're also a distraction. The interesting questions are these. Why, of all the post-government opportunities available to former White House advisor, did Jared Kushner choose a strategically located former military island honeycombed with Cold War tunnels? Who introduced him to it? Where is the money coming from? And given who his introducer is and who the introducer's social circle is, should anybody be entirely comfortable with the luxury eco-resort pitch at face value? The answers, as far as they go, are documented. Kushner told the All In podcast that he discovered the island while on vacation aboard the yacht of his friend Nathaniel Rothschild, and that he later met privately with Edi Rama aboard the same yacht to begin discussions. Affinity Partners' principal known investor is the Saudi Public Investment Fund, which wired Kushner $2 billion in 2021 over the objections of its own screening committee. And Nate Rothschild's documented social network, the people he has worked with, sued, sailed with, and been photographed with for at least two decades, overlaps in non-trivial ways with the social network that ran Jeffrey Epstein's last decade. Yeah, they're This is not a piece arguing that Kushner is building Epstein's island. It's a piece arguing that the network around Kushner is harder to dismiss than the press has been willing to dismiss it so far. Sazan is unlike any other piece of land currently being marketed to tourists in the Mediterranean. Beneath the vine and fig trees lie roughly 3,600 one-man nuclear bunkers and kilometers of tunnels and underground facilities, including a cinema, a school, and a hospital. Smithsonian Magazine, covering the island's first opening to tourism that same year, described an intact network of bunkers and tunnels used by Cold War soldiers. The Soviet Union maintained a whiskey-class submarine base there in the late 1950s, and Western open-source reporting has long alleged a chemical weapons facility, although no party has officially confirmed it. For most of the 20th century, the island was strictly off limits to civilians. It opened limited to tourism in 2015. In December 2024, the Albanian government declassified the island for civilian development. Atlanta Incubation Partners' Kushner vehicle was named Strategic Investor, a designation that allows expedited permits, fast-tracking environmental review, and a bundle of incentives unavailable to ordinary applicants. The developer scope, as reported by the Albanian and international press, is enormous. As many as 10,000 hotel rooms and villas spread across the island in adjacent coastal areas. Restoration and adaptive reuse of the Cold War era military structures, a marina, and Aman Resorts managed flagship hotel and perimeters that would include parts of the lagoon and ecologically protected wetlands that serves as a stopover for migrating flamingos and a habitat for monk seals and sea turtles. Again, you know, he's just connecting the Rothschilds to this, the SPAK investigation into it. A billionaire Rothschild heir owns the Explorer superyacht, so cool it was featured in Christopher Nolan's blockbuster. Now he's selling it for $87 million. The five-decker vessel boasts a helipad, an observation lounge, a cinema, and an opulent owner's deck. wasn't nice for him. His public record is colorful. In 2008, Rothschild hosted then EU Trade Commissioner Peter Mandelson and then Shadow Chancellor George Osborne separately aboard the mega yacht of Russian aluminum oligarch Oleg Deripaska off Corfu, a scandal that produced a parliamentary inquiry in London, a public quarrel between Rothschild and Osborne in the press, and eventually a libel suit by Rothschild against the Daily Mail's parent company over its coverage of the Mandelson visit. Mandelson, of course, who was forced to resign because he had been providing insider information to Jeffrey Epstein and that his connections to the Epstein crime syndicate were covered up during his review, and he was allowed to take the positions despite the connections he had actually making him ineligible for the role. Deripaska, for the record, is sanctioned by the United States, the United Kingdom, and the European Union. It's widely described in open-source reporting as Putin's oligarch. He's the same Deripaska who employed Paul Manafort as a political consultant in the 2000s and who featured prominently in the Mueller report as the recipient of Manafort's offer for private briefings during the 2016 campaign. Rothschild's commercial career had been similar to had been similarly Russia adjacent. His investment vehicle Valar PLC, located on the London Stock Exchange in 2010, eventually became Bumi PLC in a reverse merger with the Indonesian Bakri family's coal interest, a transaction that collapsed in acrimony, litigation, and a near total wipeout of public shareholders. He has been an investment in the EN Plus Group, Deripaska's hydroelectric and aluminum holding company. He's also spent the last decade quietly building holdings in Montenegro, Albania's coastal neighbor, where he holds citizenship. The pattern across two decades of public reporting is consistent. Rothschild is the man whose yacht the politicians are on, whose planes they are on, whose Adriatic compound they are on. He is the broker as well as the host. The pattern is so well established that the Albanian press, in covering the Sazan deal, has not had to invent any framing for it. They simply restated what Kushner told the All In podcast. Here's where the DOJ Epstein file release intersects with the Sazan story. Nathaniel Rothschild does not appear in Jeffrey Epstein's flight logs. He does not appear in the so-called Black Book by first name. What he does appear in repeatedly is the email correspondence of Peter Mandelson, Rothschild's close friend, one of Kushner's indirect predecessors in the role of the politician on Deripaska's yacht, and one of Jeffrey Epstein's documented intimates from 2002 through at least 2011. The Mandelson-Epstein emails released by the House Oversight Committee in November 2025 and reinforced by the DOJ release in December are now a matter of public record. They span a decade. They show Mandelson seeking Epstein's advice on his post-government career, gossiping with Epstein about mutual acquaintances, accepting Epstein's hospitality, and, most relevant here, using Epstein as a back channel to help Nate Rothschild, or Nat Rothschild. It feels wrong calling him a Nat. Right? Gnats are annoying little bugs. We'll call them tick. That's an annoying blood-sucking animal, so maybe more appropriate. Tick Rothschild does not appear in Jeffrey Epstein's flight logs. The Mandelson-Epstein emails released by the House Oversight Committee in November 2025 and reinforced by the DOJ release in December are now a matter of public record. They span a decade. They show Mandelson seeking Epstein's advice. I just read that. In April 2010, Mandelson forwarded Epstein an email he had written to Jez Staley, then a senior executive at J.P. Morgan. The forwarded message read in part, "I've been following my friend Tick Rothschild's plan to list a vehicle on the LSE, and I'm very happy JPM are now planning to get involved in bookrunners alongside Credit Suisse." Mandelson was, by his own admission to Epstein, using their relationship to help promote the Rothschild's London listing, the Valar vehicle that would later become Bumi. Epstein's reply, captured in the release files, is characteristic. "You are so devious." Epstein understood exactly what he was reading. Mandelson laundering a favor for the Rothschild through an Epstein-adjacent banker. Now, the more I learn about these guys, you know, the less I trust them. And the more I learn about this Epstein guy, the less I'm convinced he's this, great guy. I don't know. I mean, you start off thinking these Epsteins, the Rothschilds, they're so rich, they're so powerful. They must be amazing people. They must be great and amazing and accomplished people to be, you know, driving around on billion-dollar yachts, meeting with every president. You know, they must be so impressive, and everybody seems to love them so much. And then you read about them, you're like, I don't think these guys are so great after all. I'm starting to think these guys aren't the good guys after all. These might actually be the heart of darkness. These people might actually be the source and engine of all the problems in the world, actually, now that I'm paying attention. It almost seems like the world would be a stable and happy place without the Jeffrey Epstein, Kushner, Soros, Rothschild cabal meddling in everything and having control of everything and lying about everything and manipulating everyone. I don't know. Here you are thinking these billionaires have our best interests in mind. Here we are just, you know, under the assumption that these massive international billionaires are working for the betterment of society and to progress humanity in love and peace. But, you know, the more I read, the less I'm convinced that that's the case. Okay? The more you learn about these people, the less you like them. This goes on and on. But again, that's just, and I got to encourage you to go to Substack. This is Tom Elliott, tomelliott.substack.com. I just read the first two pages verbatim, almost three, but it goes on for at least another five or six pages. And it connects, you know, all these people and their various nefarious activities with the purchase of this island, which is obviously some sort of cover up for some sort of Israeli activity. And yeah, I didn't realize they were doing it in South Africa, too. So just off the top of my head, we've got the islands in Greece, the islands in Albania, the coastal land of Italy, all being purchased in large amounts by Israel, often, you know, former military compound places. Obviously, they're taking over Syria. Obviously, they're taking over Lebanon and Gaza. But they're also apparently making agreements with the Argentinian government to allow a, quote unquote, mini Israel to exist in Patagonia. They also obviously have entire communities in places like New Jersey here, as exposed by Tyler Oliveira. But you know, they also have an entire oblast in Russia that they run. Ukraine, essentially, is theirs to run roughshod with. They're also apparently building colonies in Thailand that the people there are not very happy about. It feels to me like the Israelis are literally setting up colonies all over the world, and they're doing it with American power and money and European, you know, power and money behind them. But I don't think it's for us. I don't. I think it's for them. I think they're evil. I think they're bad. I think they need to be stopped by all means necessary. That's about going to do it for us here this week on War Room Live. Follow us, of course, on Rumble, rumble.com/TheWarRoomLive. We are on X at AJN Live. I'm at Harrison H. Smith. Support us by going to thealexjonesstore.com/Harrison. That's so they know who sent you. And we'll see you next Monday.